Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Hey guys, you're watching War Stories on the Fox Business Network. Well, in the new war film, American Sniper, we witnessed the real-life story of one soldier's struggle on and off the battlefield. I was honored to have sat down with Chris Kyle's widow, Taya, and asked why she wanted her husband's story shared.
I was incredibly proud of him, and I was in awe of the way that he did that. And I know he had to fight tooth and nail to get back to who he was, but he did it. Just like everything else in his life, he made up his mind and he did it.
You're home?
I'm coming home.
Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm good.
And I can tell you that I feel honored to have this movie about him. I know that that's something not very many people get when their loved ones are gone, is an opportunity to share them.
Such a powerful film, folks, so be sure to check out American Sniper in theaters now. And stay tuned for even more war stories right here on the Fox Business Network.
Context of white supremacy, justice, gusty, renegade, and for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, January 16th, 2015. So I have been told. Another reason to be paying attention to the book we're on right now, American Sniper, autobiography of Chris Kyle, white killer. Now that the Oscars are about to be announced, there's been a lot of dialogue about Selma not getting very many Oscar nominations. It was nominated for Best Picture, but American Sniper getting a trough full of nominations for all types of awards this season. And in fact, the LA Times, they did a pretty big write-up on the difference between the two, and they did, obviously, racism was a component of why they think there was such a disparity between American Sniper getting so many nominations and Selma not getting very many nominations. But at any rate, as I've said consistently, whether we're talking Pulp Fiction, Forrest Gump, The Help, Hurt Locker, even The Blind Side, those Academy Awards, that right there tells you a lot about what racist woman, racist man, racist child, what they value, what is important about white supremacy culture. With that, we will get started. We are still in Chapter 5, subtitle Fry Me Not, American Sniper, Chris Kyle, Context of White Supremacy.
Fry me not. You cannot be afraid to take your shot. When you see someone with an IED or a rifle maneuvering toward your men, you have clear reason to fire. The fact that an Iraqi had a gun would not necessarily mean he could be shot. The ROEs were specific, and in most cases, the danger was obvious. But there were times when it wasn't exactly clear, when a person almost surely was an insurgent, probably was doing evil, but there was still some doubt because of the circumstances or the surroundings. The way he moved, for example, wasn't toward an area where troops were. A lot of times a guy seemed to be acting macho for friends, completely unaware that I was watching him, or that there were American troops nearby. Those shots I didn't take. You couldn't. You had to worry about your own ass. Make an unjustified shot, and you could be charged with murder. I often would sit there and think, I know this motherfucker is bad. I saw him doing such and such down the street the other day. But here he's not doing anything, and if I shoot him, I won't be able to justify it for the lawyers. I'll fry. Like I said, there is paperwork for everything. Every confirmed kill had documentation, support and evidence, and a witness. So I wouldn't shoot. There weren't a lot of those, especially in Fallujah, but I was always extremely aware of the fact that every killing might have to be justified to the lawyers. My attitude was, If my justification is I thought my target would do something bad, then I wasn't justified. He had to be doing something bad. Even with that standard, there were plenty of targets. I was averaging 2 and 3 a day, occasionally less, sometimes much more, with no end in sight. A squat water tower rose above the rooftops a few blocks from one of the roofs where we were perched. It looked like a wide yellow tomato. We'd already moved a few blocks past the tower when a Marine decided to climb up and retrieve the Iraqi flag flying from the gridwork. As he climbed, the insurgents who had lain low during the earlier attack began firing on him. Within seconds, he was shot up and trapped. We backtracked over, moving along the streets and across the rooftops until we found the men shooting at him. When we had the area cleared, we sent up one of our guys to retrieve the flag. After we got it down, we sent it to the Marine in the hospital. Runaway shows his colors. Not long afterward, a guy I'll call Runaway and I were on the street when we had contact with Iraqi insurgents. We ducked into a shallow setback in the wall next to the street, waiting for the hail of bullets to die down. "We'll work our way back," I told Runaway. "You go first. I'll cover you." "Good." I leaned out and laid down cover fire, forcing the Iraqis back. I waited a few seconds, giving Runaway time to get into position so he could cover me. When I thought enough time had passed, I jumped out and started running. Bullets began flying all around me, but not from Runaway. They were all coming from the Iraqis, who were trying to write their names in my back with bullets. I threw myself against the wall, sliding next to the gate. For a moment, I was disoriented. Where was Runaway? He should have been nearby, waiting under cover for me so we could leapfrog back, but he was nowhere to be seen. Had I passed him on the street? No. Motherfucker was busy earning his nickname. I was trapped, hung up by the insurgents, and without my mysteriously disappearing friend. The Iraqi gunfire got so intense that I ended up having to call for backup. The Marines sent a pair of Hummers, and with their firepower backing up everything I could lay down, I was finally able to get out. By then, I'd figured out what had happened. When I met with Runaway a short time later, I practically strangled him. I probably would have if it hadn't been for the officer there. "Why the hell did you run away?" I demanded. "You ran all the way down the block without covering me." "I thought you were following me." "Bullshit." It was the second time that week Runaway had taken off on me under fire. The first time I'd cut him slack, giving him the benefit of the doubt, but it was now clear he was a coward. Once he was under fire, he just pussied out. Command separated us. It was a wise thing to do. "We're just gonna shoot." A little after Runaway's exciting adventure, I came down from my position on one of the roofs when I heard a shit ton of rounds go off nearby. I ran outside but couldn't see the firefight. Then I heard a radio call that there were men down. Me and a fellow I'll call Eagle ran up the block until we came across a group of Marines who'd retreated after taking fire about a block away. They told us that a group of insurgents had pinned down some other Marines not too far away, and we decided we'd try to help them. We tried getting an angle from a nearby house, but it wasn't tall enough. Eagle and I moved closer, trying another house. Here we found 4 Marines on the roof, 2 of whom had been wounded. Their stories were confusing, and we couldn't get shots from there either. We decided to take them out so the wounded could be helped. The kid I carried down had been gut shot. Down on the street, we got better directions from the 2 Marines who hadn't been shot, finally realizing that we had been targeting the wrong house. We started down an alley in the direction of the insurgents, but after a short distance, we came to obstructions we couldn't get around, and we reversed course. Just as I came around the corner back out onto the main street, there was an explosion behind me. An insurgent had seen us coming and tossed a grenade. One of the Marines following me went down. Eagle was a corpsman, as well as a sniper, and after we pulled the injured kid away from the alley, he went to work on him. Meanwhile, I took the rest of the Marines and continued down the road in the direction of the insurgent's stronghold. We found a second group of Marines huddled at a nearby corner, pinned down by fire from the house. They'd set out to rescue the first group, but stalled. I got everyone together, and I told them that a small group of us would rush up the street while the others laid down fire. The trapped Marines were about 50 yards away, about 1 full block. It doesn't matter if you can see him or not, I told him. We're all just gonna shoot. I got up to start. A terrorist jumped out in the middle of the road and began unleashing hell on us, spitting bullets from a belt-fed weapon. Returning fire as best we could, we ducked back for cover. Everybody checked themselves for holes. Miraculously, no one had been shot. By now, somewhere between 15 and 20 Marines were there with me. All right, I told them, we're going to try this again. Let's do it this time. I jumped out from around the corner, firing my weapon as I ran. The Iraqi machine gunner had been hit and killed by our earlier barrage, but there were still plenty of bad guys farther up the street. I'd taken only a few steps when I realized that none of the Marines had followed me. Shit! I kept running. The insurgents began focusing their fire on me. I tucked my Mark 11 under my arm and fired back as I ran. The semi-automatic is a great, versatile weapon, but in this particular situation, its 20-round magazine seemed awful small. I blew through one mag, popped the release, slammed in a second, and kept firing. I found four men huddled near a wall not far from the house. It turned out that two of them were reporters who'd been embedded with the Marines. They were getting a hell of a better view of the battle than they had bargained for. "I'll cover you," I shouted. "Get the hell out of here." I jumped up and laid down fire as they ran. The final Marine tapped me on my shoulder as he passed, signaling that he was the last man out. Ready to follow, I glanced to my right, checking my flank. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a body sprawled on the ground. He had Marine camis. Where he came from, whether he'd been there when I arrived or crawled there from somewhere else, I have no idea. I ran over to him, saw that he'd been shot in both legs. I slapped a new mag into my gun, then grabbed the back of his body armor and pulled him with me as I retreated. At some point as I ran, one of the insurgents threw a frag. The grenade exploded somewhere nearby. Pieces of wall peppered my side, from my butt cheek down to my knee. By some lucky chance, my pistol took the biggest fragment. It was pure luck. It might have put a nice hole in my leg. My butt was sore for a while, but it still seems to work well enough. We made it back to the rest of the Marines without either of us getting hit again. I never found out who that wounded guy was. I've been told he was a second lieutenant, but I never had a chance to track him down. The other Marine said I saved his life, but it wasn't just me. Getting all those guys to safety was a joint effort. We all worked together. The Corps was grateful that I had helped rescue their people, and one of the officers put me in for a Silver Star. According to the story I heard, the general sitting at their desks decided that since no Marines had gotten Silver Stars during the assault, they weren't going to award one to a SEAL. I got a Bronze Star with a V for Valor in Combat instead. Makes me smirk just to think about it. Medals are all right, but they have a lot to do with politics, and I'm not a fan of politics. All told, I would end my career as a SEAL with 2 Silver Stars and 5 Bronze Medals, all for Valor. I'm proud of my service, but I sure as hell didn't do it for any medal. They don't make me any better or less than any other guy who served. Medals never tell the whole story. And like I said, in the end, they become more political than accurate. I've seen men who deserved a lot more and men who deserved a lot less rewarded by higher-ups negotiating for whatever public cause they were working on at the time. For all these reasons, they are not on display at my house or in my office. My wife is always encouraging me to organize or frame the paperwork on them and display the medals. Political or not, she thinks they are a part of the story of my service. Maybe I'll get around to it someday. More likely, I won't. My uniform was covered with so much blood from the assault that the Marines got one of their own for me. From that point on, I looked like a Marine in digi-cami. It was a little weird to be wearing someone else's uniform, but it was also an honor to be considered a member of the team to the point where they'd outfit me. Even better, they gave me a fleece jacket and a fleece beanie. It was cold out there. Taya. After one deployment, we were driving in the car and Chris said, just out of the blue, did you know there is a certain kind of smell when someone dies in a particular way? And I said, no, I didn't know that. And gradually I got the story. It was suitably gruesome. Stories would just come out. A lot of times he said things to see what I could handle. I told him I really, truly did not care what he did in wartime. He had my unconditional support. Still, he needed to go slow to test the waters. I think he needed to know I wouldn't look at him differently, and perhaps more than that, he knew we would deploy again, and he didn't want to scare me. As far as I can see it, anyone who has a problem with what guys do over there is incapable of empathy. People want America to have a certain image when we fight. Yet, I would guess if someone were shooting at them, and they had to hold their family members while they bled out against an enemy who hid behind their children, played dead only to throw a grenade as they got closer, and who had no qualms about sending their toddler to die from a grenade from which they personally pulled the pin, they would be less concerned with playing nicely. Chris followed the ROEs because he had to. Some of the more broad-spectrum ROEs are fine. The problem with the ROEs covering minutiae is that terrorists really don't give a shit about the Geneva Convention, so picking apart a soldier's every move against a dark, twisted, rule-free enemy is more than ridiculous. It's despicable. I care about my husband and other Americans coming home alive, so other than being concerned for his safety, I truly wasn't afraid to hear anything he wanted to share. Even before I heard the stories, I don't think I was ever under illusions that war is pretty or nice. When he told me the story about killing someone up close, all I thought was, thank God he's okay. Then I thought, you're kind of a badass. Wow. Mostly, we didn't talk about killing or the war, but then it would intrude. Not always in a bad way. One day Chris was getting his oil changed at a local shop. Some men were in the lobby with him. The guy behind the counter called Chris's name. Chris paid his bill and sat back down. One of the guys waiting for his own vehicle looked up at him and said, are you Chris Kyle? And Chris said, yeah. Were you in Fallujah? Yeah. Holy shit, you're the guy who saved our ass. The guy's father was there, and he came over to thank Chris and shake his hand. They were all saying, you were great. You got more kills than anyone. Chris got embarrassed and very humbly said, y'all saved my ass, too. And that was it. 7. Down in the shit. On the street. The kid looked at me with a mixture of excitement and disbelief. He was a young Marine, eager but tempered by the fight we'd been waging the past week. Do you want to be a sniper? I asked him. Right now? Hell yeah, he said finally. Good, I told him, handing over my Mark 11. Give me your M16. You take my sniper rifle. I'm going in the front door. And with that, I headed over to the squad we'd been working with and told them I was helping them hit the houses. Over the past few days, the insurgents had stopped coming out to fight us. Our kill rate from the overwatches had declined. The bad guys were all staying inside because they knew if they came outside, we were going to shoot them. They didn't give up. Instead, they would take their stands inside the houses, ambushing and battling the Marines in the small rooms and tiny hallways. I was seeing a lot of our guys being carried out and medevaced. I'd been turning the idea of going down on the street over in my head for a while before finally deciding to go ahead with it. I picked out one of the privates who'd been helping the sniper team. He seemed like a good kid with a lot of potential. Part of the reason I went down on the streets was because I was bored. The bigger part was that I felt that I could do a better job protecting the Marines if I was with them. They were going in the front door of these buildings and getting whacked. I'd watch as they went in, hear gunshots, and then the next thing I knew they'd be hauling someone out in a stretcher because he just got shot up. It pissed me off. I love the Marines, but the truth is these guys had never been taught to do room clearances like I had. It's not a Marine specialty. They were all tough fighters, but they had a lot to learn about urban warfare. Much was simple stuff. How to hold your rifle as you come into a room so it's hard for someone else to grab. Where to move as you enter the room. How to fight 360 degrees in a city. Things that SEALs learn so well we can do them in our sleep. The squad didn't have an officer. The highest ranking NCO was a staff sergeant, an E6 in the Marine Corps. I was an E5, junior to him, but he didn't have a problem letting me take control of the takedowns. We'd already been working together for a while, and I think I'd won a certain amount of respect. Plus, he didn't want his guys getting shot up either. Look, I'm a SEAL. You're Marines, I told the boys. I'm no better than you are. The only difference between you and me is I've spent more time specializing and training in this than you did. Let me help you. We trained a little bit during the break. I gave some of my explosives to one of the squad members with experience in explosives. We did a little run-through on how to blow locks off. Until that point, they'd had such a small amount of explosives that they'd mostly been knocking the doors in, which, of course, took time and made them more vulnerable. Break time over, we started going in. Inside. I took the lead. Waiting outside the first house, I thought about the guys I saw being pulled out. I did not want to be one of them. I could be, though. It was hard to get that idea out of my mind. I also knew that I would be in a shitload of trouble if I did get hurt. Going down on the streets was not what I was supposed to be doing, at least from an official point of view. It was definitely right, what I felt I had to do, but it would severely piss the top brass off. But that would be the least of my problems if I got shot, wouldn't it? Let's do it, I said. We blew the door in. I led the way, training and instincts taken over. I cleared the front room, stepped to the side, and started directing traffic. The pace was quick, automatic. Once things got started and I began to move into the house, something took over inside me. I didn't worry about casualties anymore. I didn't think about anything except the door, the house, the room, all of which was plenty enough. Going into a house, you never knew what you were going to find. Even if you cleared the rooms on the first floor without any trouble, you couldn't take the rest of the house for granted. Going up to the second floor, you might start to get a feeling that the rooms were empty or that you weren't going to have any problems up there, but that was a dangerous feeling. You never really know what's anywhere. Each room had to be cleared, and even then, you had to be on your guard. Plenty of times after we secured a house, we took rounds and grenades from outside. While many of the houses were small and cramped, we also made our way through a well-to-do area of the city as the battle progressed. Here the streets were paved and the buildings looked like miniature palaces from the outside. But once you got past the facade and looked in the rooms, most were broken messes. Any Iraqi who had that much money had fled or been killed. During our breaks, I would take the Marines out and go through some drills with them. While other units were taking their lunch, I was teaching them everything I'd learned about room clearance. "Look, I don't want to lose a guy," I yelled at them. I wasn't about to get an argument there. I ran them around, busting their asses while they were supposed to be resting. But that's the thing with Marines. You beat them down and they come back for more. We broke into one house with a large front room. We'd caught the inhabitants completely by surprise. But I was surprised as well. As I burst in, I saw a whole bunch of guys standing there in desert camouflage, the old brown chocolate chip stuff from Desert Storm, the first Gulf War. They were all wearing gear. They were all Caucasian, including one or two with blonde hair. Obviously not Iraqis or Arabs. What the fuck? We looked at each other. Something flicked in my brain. I flicked the trigger on the M16, mowing them down. A half second's more hesitation, and I would have been the one bleeding out on the floor. They turned out to be Chechens, Muslims apparently recruited for a holy war against the West. We found their passports after searching the house. Old man. I have no idea how many blocks, let alone how many houses we took down. The Marines were following a carefully laid out plan. We had to be at a certain spot each lunchtime, then reach another objective by nightfall. The entire invasion force moved across the city in choreographed order, making sure there were no holes or weak spots the insurgents could use to get behind us and attack. Every once in a while, we'd come across a building still occupied by families, but for the most part, the only people we were seeing were insurgents. We would do a full search of each house. In this one house, we heard faint moans as we went down into the basement. There were two men hanging from chains on the wall. One was dead, the other barely there. Both had been severely tortured with electric shock and God knows what else. They were both Iraqi, apparently mentally retarded. The insurgents had wanted to make sure they wouldn't talk to us, but decided to have a little fun with them first. The second man died while our corpsman worked on him. There was a black banner on the floor, the kind the fanatics like to show on their videos when beheading Westerners. There were amputated limbs and more blood than you can imagine. It was a nasty-smelling place. After a couple of days, one of the Marine snipers decided to come down with me, and both of us started leading the DAs. We would take a house on the right side of the street, then cross to the left and take the house across the way. Back and forth, back and forth. All of this took a lot of time. We'd have to go around the gates, get to the doors, blow up the doors, rush in. The scum inside had plenty of time to get prepared, not to mention the fact that even with what I'd contributed, we were running out of explosives. A Marine armored vehicle was working with us, moving down the center of the street as we went. It only had a 50 cal for a weapon, but its real asset was its size. No Iraqi wall could stand up to it once it got ahead of steam. I went over to the commander. "Look, here's what I want you to do," I told him. "We're running out of explosives. Run through the wall in front of the house and put about 5 rounds of 50 cal through the front door. Then back up, and we'll take it from there." So we started doing it that way, saving explosives and moving much faster. Pounding up and down the stairs, running to the roof, coming back down, hitting the next house. We got to where we were taking from 50 to 100 houses a day. The Marines were hardly winded, but I lost over 20 pounds in those 6 or so weeks I was in Fallujah. Most of it I sweated off on the ground. It was exhausting work. The Marines were all a lot younger than me, practically teenagers, some of them. I guess I still had a bit of a baby face because when we'd get to talking, and for some reason or another I'd tell them how old I was, they'd stare at me and say, "You're that old?" I was 30, an old man in Fallujah. Just another day. As the Marine drive neared the southern edge of the city, the ground action in our section started to peter out. I went back up on the roofs and started doing overwatches again, thinking I could catch more targets from there. The tide of the battle had turned. The U.S. had mostly wrested control of the city from the bad guys, and it was now just a matter of time before resistance collapsed. But being in the middle of the action, I couldn't tell for sure. Knowing that we considered cemeteries sacred, the insurgents typically used them to hide caches of weapons and explosives. At one point, we were in a hide overlooking the walled-in boundaries of a large cemetery that sat in the middle of the city. Roughly 3 football fields long by 2 football fields wide, it was a cement city of the dead, filled with tombstones and mausoleums. We set up on a roof near a prayer tower and mosque overlooking the cemetery. The roof we were on was fairly elaborate. It was ringed with a brick wall punctuated with iron grates, giving us excellent firing positions. I sat down on my haunches and spotted in my rifle through a gap in the gridwork, studying the paths between the stones a few hundred yards out. There was so much dust and grit in the air, I kept my goggles on. I'd also learned in Fallujah to keep my helmet cinched tight, wary of the chips and cement fragments that flew from the battered masonry during a firefight. I picked out some figures moving through the cemetery yard. I zeroed in on one and fired. Within seconds, we were fully engaged in a firefight. Insurgents kept popping up from behind the stones. I don't know if there was a tunnel or where they came from. Brass flew from the 60 nearby. I studied my shots as the Marines around me poured out fire. Everything they did faded into the background as I carefully put my scope on a target, steadied the aim on center mass, and squeezed ever so smoothly. When the bullet leapt from the barrel, it was almost a surprise. My target fell. I looked for another, and another, and on it went. Until finally, there were no more. I got up and moved a few feet to a spot where the wall completely shielded me from the cemetery. There I took my helmet off and leaned back against the wall. The roof was littered with spent shells, hundreds, if not thousands. Someone shared a large plastic bottle of water. One of the Marines pulled his ruck over and used it as a pillow, catching some sleep. Another went downstairs to the store on the first story of the building. It was a smoke shop. He returned with cartons of flavored cigarettes. He lit a few, and a cherry scent mingled with the heavy stench that always hung over Iraq, a smell of sewage and sweat and death. just another day in Fallujah. The streets were covered with splinters and various debris. The city, never exactly a showcase, was a wreck. Squashed water bottles sat in the middle of the road next to piles of wood and twisted metal. We worked on one block of three-story buildings where the bottom level was filled with shops. Each of their awnings were covered with a thick layer of dust and grit, turning the bright colors of the fabric into a hazy blur. Metal shields blocked most of the storefronts. They were pockmarked with shrapnel chips. A few had handbills showing insurgents wanted by the legitimate government. I have a few photos from that time. Even in the most ordinary and least dramatic scenes, the effects of war are obvious. Every so often, there's a sign of normal life before the war, something that has nothing to do with it. A kid's toy, for example. War and peace don't seem to go together right. The best sniper shot ever. The Air Force, Marines, and Navy were flying air support missions above us. We had enough confidence in them that we could call in strikes just down the block. One of our comm guys, working a street over from us, was with a unit that came under heavy fire from a building packed with insurgents. He got on the radio and called over to the Marines, asking permission to call in an airstrike. As soon as it was approved, he got on the line with the pilot and gave him the location and details. "Danger close," he warned over the radio. "Take cover." We ducked inside the building. I have no idea how big the bomb he dropped was, but the explosion rattled the walls. My buddy later reported it had taken out over 30 insurgents, as much an indication of how many people were trying to kill us as how important the air support was. I have to say that all of the pilots we had overhead were pretty accurate. In a lot of situations, we were asking for bombs and missiles to hit within a few hundred yards. That's pretty damn close when you're talking about 1,000 or more pounds of destruction. But we didn't have any incidents, and I was also pretty confident that they could handle the job. One day, a group of Marines near us started getting fire from a minaret in a mosque a few blocks away. We could see where the gunman was shooting from, but we couldn't get a shot on him. He had a perfect position, able to control a good part of the city below him. While ordinarily anything connected to a mosque would have been out of bounds, the sniper's presence made it a legitimate target. We called an airstrike on the tower, which had a high windowed dome at the top, with two sets of walkways running around it that made it look a little like an air traffic control tower. The roof was made of panels of glass topped by a spiked pole. We hunkered down as the aircraft came in. The bomb flew through the sky, hit the top of the minaret, and went straight through one of the large panes at the top. It then continued down into a yard across the alley. There it went low order, exploding without much visible impact. "Shit," I said. "He missed." "Come on, let's go get the son of a bitch ourselves." We ran down a few blocks and entered the tower, climbing what seemed an endless flight of stairs. At any moment, we expected the sniper security or the sniper himself to appear above and start firing at us. No one did. When we made it to the top, we saw why. The sniper, alone in the building, had been decapitated by the bomb as it flew through the window. But that wasn't all the bomb did. By chance, the alley where it landed had been filled with insurgents. We found their bodies and weapons a short time later. I think it was the best sniper shot I ever saw. Redistributed. After I'd been working with Kilo Company for about 2 weeks, the commanders called all the SEAL snipers back so they could redistribute us where we were needed. "What the hell are you doing out there?" asked one of the first SEALs I met. "We're hearing shit that you're down there on the ground." "Yeah, I am. No one's coming out on the street." "What the hell are you doing?" he said, pulling me aside. "You know if our CO finds out you're doing this, you're out of here." He was right, but I shrugged him off. I knew in my heart what I had to do. I also felt pretty confident in the officer who was my immediate commander. He was a straight shooter and all about doing the job that needed to get done. Not to mention the fact that I was so far out of touch with my top command that it would have taken a long time for them to find out, let alone issue the orders to get me pulled out. A bunch of other guys came over and started agreeing with me. Down on the street was where we needed to be. I have no idea what they ended up doing, Certainly, for the record, they all remained on the roofs, sniping. "Well, hell, instead of using that Marine M16, said one of the East Coast boys, "I brought my M4 with me. You can borrow it if you want." "Really?" "I took it and wound up getting a bunch of kills on it. The M16 and the M4 are both good weapons. The Marines prefer the latest model of the M16 for various reasons that have to do with the way they usually fight. Of course, my preference in close-quarters combat was for the short-barreled M4, and I was glad to borrow my friend's gun for the rest of my time in Fallujah. I was assigned to work with Lima Company, which was operating a few blocks away from Kilo. Lima was helping fill in holes, taking down pockets of insurgents who had crept in or been bypassed. They were seeing a lot of action. That night, I went over and talked to the company leadership in a house they'd taken over earlier in the day. The Marine commander had already heard what I'd been doing with Kilo, and after we talked a bit, he asked what I wanted to do. "I'd like to be down on the street with y'all." "Good enough." Lima Company proved to be another great group of guys. Don't tell my mom. A few days later, we were clearing a block when I heard shooting on a nearby street. I told the Marines I was with to stay where they were, then ran over to see if I could help. I found another group of Marines who had started up an alley and run into heavy fire. They'd already pulled back and gotten under cover by the time I got there. One kid hadn't quite made it. He was lying on his back some yards away, crying in pain. I started laying down fire and ran up to grab him and pull him back. When I got to him, I saw he was in pretty bad shape, gut shot. I dropped and got an arm under each of his, then started hauling him backward. Somehow I managed to slip as I went. I fell backward with him on top of me. By that point, I was so tired and winded, I just laid there for a few minutes, still in the line of fire as bullets shot by. The kid was about 18 years old. He was really badly hurt. I could tell he was going to die. "Please don't tell my mama I died in pain," he muttered. "Shit, kid, I don't even know who you are," I thought. "I'm not telling your mama anything." "Okay, okay," I said. "Don't worry, don't worry. Everybody will make it sound great, real great." He died right then. He didn't even live long enough to hear my lies about how everything was going to be okay. A bunch of Marines came. They lifted him off me and put him in the back of a Hummer. We called in a bomb strike and took out the shooting positions where the fire had come from, at the other end of the alley. I went on back to my block and continued the fight. Thanksgiving. I thought about the casualties I'd seen and the fact that I could be the next one carried out. But I wasn't going to quit. I wasn't going to stop going into houses or stop supporting them from the roofs. I couldn't let down these young Marines I was with. I told myself, I'm a SEAL. I'm supposed to be tougher and better. I'm not going to give up on them. It wasn't that I thought I was tougher or better than they were. It was that I knew that was the way people looked at us, and I didn't want to let those people down. I didn't want to fail in their eyes, or in mine. That's the line of thinking that's beaten into us. We're the best of the best. We're invincible. I don't know if I'm the best of the best, but I did know that if I quit, I wouldn't be. And I certainly did feel invincible. I had to be. I'd made it through all sorts of shit without getting killed. So far. Thanksgiving shot past while we were in the middle of the battle. I remember getting my Thanksgiving meal. They halted the assault for a bit, maybe a half hour, and brought up food to us on the rooftop where we'd set up. Turkey, mashed potatoes, stuffing, green beans for 10, all in a large box. Together, no separate boxes, no compartments, all in one pile. Also, no plates, no forks, no knives, no spoons. We dipped our hands in and ate with our fingers. That was Thanksgiving. Compared to the MREs we'd been eating, it was awesome. Attacking the Marsh. I stayed with Lima for roughly a week, then went back to Kilo. It was terrible to hear who'd been hit and who they'd lost in the time I'd been gone. With the assault about finished, we were given a new task, set up a cordon to make sure no insurgents were able to get back in. Our sector was over by the Euphrates on the western side of the town. From this point on, I was a sniper again, and figuring that my shots would now mostly be at longer range, I went back to the 300 Win Mag. We set up in a two-story house overlooking the river, a few hundred yards down from Blackwater Bridge. There was a marshy area immediately across the river, completely overgrown with weeds and everything. It was near a hospital the insurgents had converted into a headquarters before our assault, and even now the area seemed to be a magnet for savages. Every night we'd have someone trying to probe in from there. Every night I would get my shots off, taking out one or two, or sometimes more. The new Iraqi army had a camp nearby. Those idiots took it in their head to send a few shots our way as well, every day. We hung a VF panel over our position, an indicator showing we were friendly, and the shots kept coming. We radioed their command. The shots kept coming. We called back and cussed out their command. The shots kept coming. We tried everything to get them to stop, short of calling in a bomb strike. Runaways return. Runaway joined me again at Kilo. I had cooled off by now and more or less kept it civil, though my feelings toward him hadn't changed. Nor, I guess, had Runaway. It was pathetic. He was up on the roof with us one night when we started taking shots from insurgents somewhere. I ducked behind a 4-foot perimeter wall. Once the gunfire subsided, I glanced over the roof and looked to see where the shots had come from. It was too dark, though. More shots were fired. Everybody ducked again. I went down just a little, hoping to see a muzzle flash in the dark when the next shot came over. I couldn't see anything. "Come on," I said. "They're not accurate. Where are they firing from?" No answer from Runaway. "Runaway, look for the muzzle flash," I said. I didn't hear a response. Two or three more shots followed, without me being able to figure out where they'd come from. Finally, I turned around to ask if he had seen anything. Runaway was nowhere to be found. He'd gone downstairs. For all I know, the only thing that stopped him was the blocked door where the Marines were pulling security. "I could get killed up there," he said when I caught up with him. I left him downstairs, telling him to send up one of the Marines pulling security in his place. At least I knew that guy wouldn't run. Runaway was eventually transferred somewhere where he couldn't go into combat. He had lost his nerve. He should have pulled himself out of there. That would have been embarrassing, but how much worse could it have been? He had to spend his time convincing everyone else that he wasn't really a pussy, when the evidence was there for everyone to see. Being the great warrior he was, Runaway declared to the Marines that SEALs and snipers were being wasted on Sniper Overwatch. "SEAL shouldn't be here. This isn't a spec op mission," he told him. But the problem wasn't just the SEALs, as he soon made clear. "Those Iraqis are going to regroup and overrun us." His prediction turned out to be just a little off. But hey, he has a bright future as a military planner. The Marsh. Our real problem was the insurgents using the marsh across the river as cover. The river coast was dotted with countless little islands with trees and brush. Here and there, an old foundation or a pile of dredged dirt and rock poked up between the bushes. Insurgents would pop up from the vegetation, take their shots, then squirrel back into the brush where you couldn't see them. The vegetation was so thick they could get pretty close not just to the river, but to us, often within 100 yards without being seen. Even the Iraqis could hit something from that distance. Making things even more complicated, a herd of water buffalo lived in the swamp, and they'd tromp through ever so often. You'd hear something or see the grass move and not know whether it was an insurgent or an animal. We tried getting creative, requesting a napalm hit on the marsh to burn down the vegetation. That idea was vetoed. As the nights went on, I realized the number of insurgents was growing. It became obvious that I was being probed. Eventually, the insurgents might be able to get enough men together that I couldn't kill them all. Not that I wouldn't have had fun trying. The Marines brought in a FAC, forward air controller, to call in air support against the insurgents. The fella they sent over was a Marine aviator, a pilot, working on a ground rotation. He tried a few times to vector in air attacks, but the requests were always denied higher up the chain of command. At the time, I was told that there had been so much devastation in the city that they didn't want any more collateral damage. I don't see how blowing up a bunch of weeds and muck would make Fallujah look any worse than it already did, but then I'm just a SEAL and obviously don't understand those sorts of complicated issues. Anyway, the pilot himself was a good guy. He didn't act stuck up or high and mighty. You'd never know he was an officer. We all liked him and respected him. And just to show there were no hard feelings, we let him get on a rifle every so often and look around. He never got off any shots. Besides the fact, the Marines sent a heavy weapon squad, more snipers, and then mortarmen. The mortarmen brought some white phosphorus shells with them, and they tried launching those in an attempt to burn down the brush. Unfortunately, the shells would only set small pieces of the marsh on fire. They'd burn a bit, then fizzle and go out because it was so wet. Our next try was throwing thermite grenades. A thermite grenade is an incendiary device that burns at 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit and can go through a quarter inch of steel in a few seconds. We went down to the river and hauled them across. That didn't work either, so we started making our own homegrown concoctions. Between the Marine sniper detail and the mortarmen, there was a great deal of creative brain power focused on that marsh. Of all the plans, one of my personal favorites involved the creative use of the shaped cheese charges that mortarmen typically carried. The cheese is used to propel mortar rounds. Distance can be adjusted by varying the amount of cheese used to fire the projectile. We'd shove some cheese in a tube, add a bunch of detcord, some diesel, and add a time fuse. Then we'd heave the contraption across the river and see what happened. We got some pretty flashes, but nothing we came up with worked real well. If only we'd had a flamethrower. The marsh remained a target-rich environment, filled with insurgents. I must have gotten 18 or 19 myself that week. The rest of the guys brought the total up to the area of 30 or more. The river seemed to hold a special fascination for bad guys. While we were trying various ways to burn down the marsh, they were attempting all sorts of ways to get across. The most bizarre involved beach balls. Beach balls and long shots. I was watching from the roof one afternoon when a group of roughly 16 fully armed insurgents emerged from cover. They were wearing full body armor and were heavily geared. We found out later that they were Tunisians, apparently recruited by one of the militant groups to fight against Americans in Iraq. Not unusual at all, except for the fact that they were also carrying four very large and colorful beach balls. I couldn't really believe what I was seeing. They split up into groups and got into the water, four men per beach ball. Then, using the beach balls to keep them afloat, they began paddling across. It was my job not to let that happen, but that didn't necessarily mean I had to shoot each one of them. Hell, I had to conserve ammo for future engagements. I shot the first beach ball. The four men began flailing for the other three balls. Snap. I shot beach ball number two. It was kind of fun. Hell, it was a lot of fun. The insurgents were fighting among themselves their ingenious plan to kill Americans now turned against them. Y'all gotta see this, I told the Marines as I shot beach ball number three. They came over to the side of the roof and watched as the insurgents fought among themselves for the last beach ball. The ones who couldn't grab on promptly sank and drowned. I watched them fight for a while longer, then shot the last ball. The Marines put the rest of the insurgents out of their misery. Those were my strangest shots. My longest came around the same time. One day a group of three insurgents appeared on the shore upriver, out of range at about 1,600 yards. That's just under a mile. A few had tried that before, standing there, knowing that we wouldn't shoot them because they were so far away. Our ROEs allowed us to take them, but the distance was so great that it really didn't make sense to take a shot. Apparently realizing they were safe, they began mocking us like a bunch of juvenile delinquents. The fact came over and started laughing at me as I eyed them through the scope. Chris, you ain't never gonna reach him. Well, I didn't say I was gonna try, but his words made it seem like almost a challenge. Some of the other Marines came over and told me more or less the same thing. Anytime someone tells me I can't do something, it gets me thinking I can do it. But 2,100 yards was so far away that my scope wouldn't even dial up the shooting solution. So I did a little mental calculation and adjusted my aim with the help of a tree behind one of the grinning insurgent idiots making fun of us. I took the shot. The moon, earth, and stars aligned. God blew on the bullet, and I gut-shot the jackass. His two buddies hauled ass out of there. Get him, yelled the Marines. Shoot him. I guess at that point they thought I could hit anything under the sun, but the truth is, I'd been lucky as hell to hit the one I was aiming at. There was no way I was taking a shot at people who were running. That would turn out to be one of my longest confirmed kills in Iraq. Misperceptions. People think that snipers take such incredibly long shots all the time. While we do take longer shots than most guys on the battlefield, they're probably a lot closer than most people think. I never got all caught up in measuring how far I was shooting. The distance really depended on the situation. In the cities, where most of my kills came, you're only going to be shooting anywhere from 200 to 400 yards anyway. That's where your targets are, so that's where your shots are. Out in the countryside, it's a different story. Typically, the shots out there would run from 800 yards to 1,200 yards. That's where the longer-range guns, like the .338, would come in handy. Someone once asked me if I had a favorite distance. My answer was easy. The closer, the better. As I mentioned earlier, another misperception people have about snipers is that we always aim for the head. Personally, I almost never target the head unless I'm absolutely sure I'm going to make the shot, and that's rare on the battlefield. I'd much rather aim center mass, shoot for the middle of the body. I've got plenty of room to play with. No matter where I hit him, he's going down. Back to Baghdad. After a week on the river, I was pulled out, swapping places with another SEAL sniper who'd been injured briefly earlier in the operation and was ready to get back into action. I'd had more than my fair share of kills as a sniper. It was time to let someone else have a go. Command sent me back to Camp Fallujah for a few days. It was one of the few breaks in the war that I actually welcomed. After the pace of the battle in the city, I was definitely ready for a brief vacation. The hot meals and showers felt pretty damn good. After chilling out for a few days, I was ordered back to Baghdad to work with Grom again. We were on the way to Baghdad when our Hummer was hit by a buried IED. The improvised explosive blew up just behind us. Everybody in the vehicles freaked, except me and another guy who'd been at Fallujah since the start of the assault. We looked at each other, winked, then closed our eyes and went back to sleep. Compared to the month's worth of explosions and shit we'd just lived through, this was nothing. While I'd been in Iraq, my platoon was sent to the Philippines on a mission to train up the local military to fight radical terrorists. It wasn't exactly the most exciting assignment. Finally, with that mission complete, they were sent to Baghdad. I went out with some other SEALs to the airport to greet them. I was expecting a big welcome. Here my family was finally coming in. They came off the plane cussing me. "Hey, asshole." And much worse than that. Like everything else they do, SEALs excel at foul language. Jealousy, thy name is SEAL. I'd wondered why I hadn't heard anything from them over the past few months. In fact, I was wondering why they were jealous. As far as I knew, they hadn't heard about anything I'd been doing. Come to find out, my chief had been regaling them with the after-action reports of my sniping in Fallujah. They'd been sitting around hand-holding the Filipinos and hating life. Well, I've been having all the fun. They got over it. Eventually, they even asked me to do a little presentation on what I'd done, complete with pointers and stuff. One more chance to use PowerPoint. Fun with the big shots. Now that they were here, I joined them and started doing some DAs. Intel would find an IED maker, or maybe a financier, give us the intel, and we'd go in and snag him. We'd hit him very early in the morning, blow his door down, rush inside, and take him before he even had a chance to get out of bed. This went on for about a month. By now, DAs were pretty much an old routine. They were a hell of a lot less dangerous in Baghdad than in Fallujah. We were living out near Biap, Baghdad International Airport, and working from there. One day my chief came over and gave me a chiefly grin. "You've got to have some fun, Chris," he told me. "You need to do a little PSD. He was using SEAL sarcasm. PSD stands for Personal Security Detail, bodyguard duty. The platoon had been assigned to provide security for high-ranking Iraqi officials. The insurgents had started kidnapping them, trying to disrupt the government. It was a pretty thankless job. So far I'd been able to avoid it, but it seemed my ninja smoke had run out. I left and went over to the other side of the city in the Green Zone. The Green Zone was a section of central Baghdad that was created as a safe area for the Allies and the new Iraqi government. It was physically cut off from the rest of the city by cement walls and barbed wire. There were only a few ways in and out, and these were under strict control. The U.S. and other Allied embassies were located there, as were Iraqi government buildings. I lasted an entire week. The Iraqi officials, so-called, were notorious for not telling their escorts what their schedules were or giving details on who was supposed to be traveling with them. Given the level of security in the Green Zone, that was a significant problem. I acted as advance. That meant I would go ahead of an official convoy, make sure the route was safe, and then stand at the security checkpoint and ID the convoy vehicles as they came through. This way, the Iraqi vehicles could move through the checkpoints quickly without becoming targets. One day I was advanced for a convoy that included the Iraqi vice president. I'd already checked the route and arrived at a Marine checkpoint outside the airport. Baghdad International was on the other side of the city from the Green Zone. While the grounds themselves were secure, the area around it and the highway leading to the gate still came under occasional fire. It was a prime terror target, since the insurgents could pretty much figure that anyone going in or out was related to the Americans or the new Iraqi government in some way. I was on radio comms with one of my boys in the convoy. He gave me the details on who was in the group, how many vehicles we had, and the like. He also told me that we had an Army Hummer in the front and an Army Hummer in the back. Simple markers I could pass along to the guards. The convoy came flying up, Hummer in the lead. We counted off the vehicles, and lo, there was the last Hummer taking up the rear. All good. All of a sudden, two more vehicles appeared behind them in hot pursuit. The Marines looked at me. "Those two are not mine," I told them. "What do you want us to do?" "Pull your Hummer out and train that 50 on them," I yelled, pulling up my M4. I jumped out in the roadway, gun raised, hoping that would get their attention. They didn't stop. Behind me, the Hummer had pulled up, and the gunner was locked and loaded. Still unsure whether I was dealing with a kidnapping or just some stray vehicles, I fired a warning shot. The cars veered off and hauled ass the other way. Thwarted kidnapping? Suicide bombers who'd lost their nerve? No, come to find out, these were two friends of the vice president. He'd forgotten to tell us about them. He wasn't too pleased. My command wasn't too pleased either. I got fired from my PSD job, which wouldn't have been all that bad except that I then had to spend the next week sitting in the Green Zone doing nothing. My platoon leadership tried to get me back for some DAs, but the headshed had decided to stick it to me a bit and kept me twiddling my thumbs. That is the worst possible torture for a SEAL. Missing out on the action. Luckily, they didn't hang on to me for too long. Haifa Street. In December 2005, Iraq geared up for national elections, its first since the fall of Saddam, and the first free and fair ones the country had ever held. The insurgency was doing everything it could to stop them. Election officials were being kidnapped left and right. Others were executed in the streets. Talk about your negative campaigning. Haifa Street in Baghdad was a particularly dangerous place. After three election officials were killed there, the army put together a plan to protect officials in the area. the strategy called for snipers to do overwatches. I was a sniper. I was available. I didn't even have to raise my hand. I joined an army unit from the Arkansas National Guard, a great bunch of good old boys, warriors all. People who are used to the traditional separation between the different military branches may think it's unusual for a SEAL to be working with the Army, or even the Marines for that matter, but the forces were often well integrated during my time in Iraq. Any unit could put in an RFF, request for forces. That request would get filled by whatever service was available. So if a unit needed snipers, as they did in this case, whatever branch had available snipers would ship them over. There's always back and forth between sailors, soldiers, and Marines, but I saw a lot of respect between the different branches, at least during the fighting. I certainly found most of the Marines and soldiers I worked with to be top-notch. You had your exceptions, but then you have your exceptions in the Navy, too. The first day I reported for my new assignment, I thought I'd need an interpreter. Some people like to harass me about my Texas twang, but these hillbillies? Holy shit! The important information came from the senior enlisted and the officers who spoke regular English, but the privates and junior guys straight out of the backwoods could have been talking Chinese for all I knew. We started working on Haifa Street right near where the three election officials had been killed. The National Guard would secure an apartment building to use as a hide. Then I'd go in, pick out an apartment, and set up. Haifa Street was not exactly Hollywood Boulevard, though it was the place to be if you were a bad guy. The street ran about 2 miles, from Assassin's Gate at the end of the Green Zone up to the northwest. It was the scene of numerous firefights and gun battles, all sorts of IED attacks, kidnappings, assassinations, you name it, and it happened on Haifa. American soldiers dubbed it Purple Heart Boulevard. The buildings we used for overwatches were 15 to 16 stories tall and had a commanding view of the road. We moved around to the extent that we could, shifting locations to keep the insurgents off balance. There were an untold number of hideouts in the squat buildings beyond the immediate highway, all up and down the street. The bad guys didn't have much of a commute to get to work. The insurgents here were a real mix. Some were Mujahideen, former Ba'ath or Iraqi Army guys. Others were loyal to Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or Sadr, or some other of the wackadoos out there. At the start, they'd wear black or sometimes these green sashes, but once they realized that set them apart, they resorted to wearing regular civilian clothes just like everyone else. They wanted to mix with civilians to make it more difficult for us to figure out who they were. They were cowards who not only would hide behind women and children, but probably hoped we'd kill the women and children since in their minds it helped their cause by making us look bad. One afternoon I watched a young teenage kid waiting for the bus below me. When the bus pulled up, a group of older teenagers and young adults got off. All of a sudden, the kid I was watching turned and started walking very quickly in the opposite direction. The group caught up quickly. One of them pulled out a pistol and put his arm around the kid's neck. As soon as he did that, I started shooting. The kid I was protecting took off. I got two or three of his would-be kidnappers. The others got away. The sons of the election officials were a favorite target. The insurgents would use the families to put pressure on the officials to drop out, or else they'd just kill the family members as a warning to others not to help the government hold the elections or even vote. The salacious and the surreal. One evening, we took over what we thought was an abandoned apartment, since it was empty when we arrived. I was rotating with another sniper, and while I was off, I went hunting around to see if there was something I might use to make the hide more comfortable. In an open drawer of a bureau, I saw all this sexy lingerie, crotchless panties, nightgowns, very suggestive stuff. Not my size, though. There was often an odd, almost surreal mix of things inside the buildings, items that would seem out of place under the best circumstances, like the car tires we found on the roof in Fallujah, or the goat we found in the bathroom of a Haifa Street apartment. I'd see something, then spend the rest of the day wondering what the story was. After a while, the bizarre came to seem natural. Not quite surprising were the TVs and satellite dishes. They were everywhere. even in the desert. Many times we'd come upon a little nomad settlement with tents for houses and nothing but a couple animals and open land around them. Still, they were bristling with satellite dishes.
Context of white supremacy. We will be picking back up. It should be, we're in chapter 6, and it's the subheading, or excuse me, chapter 7, actually. Chapter 7, the subheading is Calling Home for Me, that is 341. 341, subheading Calling Home, chapter 7. That's what we'll be picking back up at for the second audio segment. Again, context of white supremacy. For folks who would like to participate, the number to dial is 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. For folks who do not want to use their phone to dial in, you can use the free Flash phone. Should be linked on the Black Talk Radio Network. If you can't access it there, the address you can use is tiny.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. That address again, tiny.cc/1race, and that is the number 1. When you put that address in, you'll see the link on the left side of the page for the free Flash phone. Click that link. It will open a tiny window on your screen. The top line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out. That number again, 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 760-569-7676. That's, make sure I don't confuse people. I always mess that up sometimes. The top line drop-down menu, select that number that I just gave out. And then on the next line, put the code in, which is 564-943. You do not need the pound sign if you're going to use the free Flash phone. And then the final line, it'll ask for name, just whatever you're comfortable with. If you're all right with a real name, that's fine. Nickname, you can press random keys even if you prefer. Once you get all three of those lines filled out, click the green button at the bottom. It should connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us if you've, you know, connected, done everything correctly. It's the same procedure if you would like to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6, and you should hear an audio prompt. Press number 1. I'll see your hand. We can get you on the program. That's it. I normally give everybody the opportunity to share before I get a comment in. It was just one thing I wanted to make sure I shared before I get to the folks who dialed in. This was on 304, and it stood out to me as being significant because they said last week during our session that they were talking about their rules of engagement, and they were talking about how churches, mosques, places of worship, these were considered sacred, and off limits, and they weren't, you know, going to carry out any attacks on these specific places. And I pointed out last week, we just had the Sikh temple shooting here in the States in 2012. For folks who've seen Selma, it opens with the bombing of the church in Birmingham that killed those four black girls. 1963, right after the March on Washington, the infamous number of black churches that were bombed that did not stop in the 60s, that continued on up into the 90s. As I said last week, there was a black church in Tennessee that had a cross burned on their property just this past summer, 2014. So just the malarkey of all that, this white man, white killer, trying to act as though there are some sort of morals in terms of white people not doing this or not doing that because they have some sort of concern or dedication to being moral when they're going out and waging war against non-white people. And it came up again this week. It was on page 304 where he says, knowing that we considered cemeteries sacred, the insurgents typically use them to hide caches of weapons and explosives. I'm not going to read the whole thing where he talks about where they end up being allowed and justified to go ahead and do the strike here, but you can Lennon Lacy, the black male in North Carolina that was mysteriously found hanging, and they ruled it a suicide. They went and desecrated his grave after he was, in my opinion, killed, murdered. The same thing with James Byrd Jr. in Texas. Not only was he killed, decapitated, dragged to death, they dumped his body in a predominantly black cemetery in Jasper, Texas. And you could just go on and on and on. Even the documentary film Banished, which talks about the history of whites terrorizing black people and driving them out of towns. One of the key stories in Arkansas, if memory serves, there was a black family and one of their, I think it was like some this black person's grandfather was buried, and he wanted to move his grandfather's remains out of this town because they had such a nasty experience with whites there, and the family didn't want to go back to this town to pay their respects and, you know, do all the things you're supposed to do to honor your ancestors. And the whites didn't even want to allow him to move the body, you know. He was just like, hey, I just want to move the remains. It's my grandfather. I've got, you know, boom, this is the deed, this is all the evidence, this is the newspaper, boom, 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 the whole nine. It's just like, eh, nah, we don't really want to do it, we don't want to do it. So that, I mean, just really stood out to me. It's just, we talked about possible fabrications and them making up things. That really stood out to me in terms of them trying to give some sort of thought or idea that whites are compelled to behave in a moral manner as it relates to burial grounds or places of worship. I think there's a long history, particularly on the continent of Africa, of them destroying and having absolute disregard for black life, black ancestors, black burial sites, black places of worship, worldwide total disregard. I just want to make sure I got that in. All the folks who dialed in with the hand up line should be open. Feel free to chime in if you have comments, feedback, things you would like to share. Person from a block number and caller at one last four digits, 1749. Your line should be open as well.
Hello, Gus.
Yes, sir.
Hi. I called last week with the notes of the first 30 minutes of the American Sniper, and I have a lot more. I didn't even go back and finished the film. I still had a lot of notes on just the first 30 minutes, but I'm going to start with the current reading. Let's see, I just have so much. I'm just trying to hurry up and summarize it to let others get a chance to speak, to do this at a glance. I'll start here first. A lot of callers were speculating that these tall tales that Cal was spitting out might have been just that, tall tales or lies or just something made up. And I came across an individual, a Navy SEAL, by the name of Christopher Heben, or Heben, I'm going to pronounce it Heben. Christopher Heben, H-E-B-E-N, age 44. Navy SEAL, convicted, let's see here, he was convicted of falsification and obscurity of not justice, but something. But anyway, this guy just made up a lie about being attacked by three black males in Ohio. You can catch this video on YouTube also. That's where I first saw him. He's on a radio talk show, and he's a Navy SEAL. He's just making up this tall tale about how he was shot in the stomach by three black men who tried to run him off the road and accosted him in the parking lot of this mall and had called him a honky and something else and shot him in the stomach and the black man took off in a sports car down the road and he chased after him, shooting at him and never calling 911 during all of this. By his story, he felt that he was succumbing to his injuries, and he pulls over in a firehouse, in a fire station parking lot where he, I guess, got some attention. But the police did a full investigation, checked the cameras along the route, which he said that this altercation took place, and checked his cell phone records to see the pinging of his cell phone, and his cell phone was not even located in this place where he said this altercation took place. There was no camera footage, and so the police charged him. Once again, his name is Chris Hebron. I advise everybody to look him up. This is a Navy SEAL on record, convicted of lying. The New York Daily News post has a great picture of him. If you look at him, he's holding a sawed-off shotgun. In my neck of the woods, that's called a donkey leg, this particular sawed-off shotgun that he's holding. And if you look at him, he looks blitzed. He looks totally fuzzed out of his mind. And then when you look up his record, he has been convicted of forging prescription-controlled substances, forging prescriptions for controlled substances. And once again, if you look at his face on the New York Daily News post, you can see that he looks like he's an abuser of substances. I advise you to check that out. Cal made the statement about hillbillies, and that struck a chord because about the ignorance of these white people who, once again, that's W-I-G-H-T when I say white, that join the military and come from these rural areas. And this is their first exposure to anything other than the inbredness that they come from. And even in the movie, Cal shows his inbred backwater Texas ignorance when he's surprised that sniping is an event in the Olympics. And this just brought to mind to me how the derogatory term, and if there's any Vietnamese listening, this is not a slight against you in any way. This is just to show the ignorance of whites. The term gook, which was heavily, matter of fact, it was used by Senator John McCain back in, I think, early 2000s, 2002, I believe, about how he hated the gooks. This is the derogatory term whites came up with to call Vietnamese people who were fighting for what they believed in. And just to show the ignorance, this term really comes from the Korean War, where the Korean term gook, G-U-K, means country, and migook, M-I-G-U-K, which means American. And these Koreans were calling the GIs, the white GIs, migook. But of course, their ignorance and hillbilly backwardness, they took it as these Koreans saying that me gook, in other words, I'm a gook. In another word, but in actuality, it was saying American. And I have some more notes, but I'm going to let somebody else speak for right now. That's what I have. Hello?
Yes, sir, we can hear you as well. Everyone who has a hand up, your line should be open.
Hello?
Hello?
I can hear both of you.
I'm finished. You're here, sir.
Oh, yeah, I just wanted to say the part when Kyle is with the Marines and they're busting through houses, and the one house he busts into with the Caucasians, and how he hesitated there. I found that to be a little surprising, how he would go into the room and, you know, he had to do a self-check, like, hold on, you know, these people in here, they look like me. But then he had to, like, remind himself, like, oh, wait, you know, they're not on my side. So he had to, you know, quickly, you know, take them out. And then later he found out, you know, they were, you know, they were actually, like, Muslims recruited against them. And another interesting part that I found was when the kid fell on top of him, the 18-year-old, and he was just dying right on top of him. I found Chris Kyle's nonchalant attitude, you know, to be interesting. He wasn't, you know, he didn't seem to be too interested in, you know, the kid, you know, really, like, following up with, like, you know, who he was, or really going out, you know, reaching out to his mom, you know, I guess, like, tell her what happened. You know, he's like, I'm not telling your mom anything. And, like, you know, once he got the kid off of him, you know, he just went right back to the streets, you know, right back into the action. So that's all I had to say.
Appreciate that. Again, everybody who has a hand up, your line should be open.
Yes, great. Did I interrupt anyone?
No.
Okay. Well, this is piggybacking on that caller who was it was funny. The first caller who seemed to be so overwhelmed with the lies. He said, I just don't know. It's just everything is a lie. It is definitely a lie. But and this last caller, you know, he's pointing out that he seems so nonchalant about the soldier dying on him. I figure there were two non-white soldiers that he's mentioned so far. Of course, Runaway, and then this other soldier that died on him, because, you know, I mean, I'm thinking about my mom, you know, and just that just, I don't know. They don't seem to be all that into their parents or anything. But, you know, he's like, yeah, who cares about your mom? Oh, I know, this sounds so much like something a black guy would say a white guy would say about a black person. So I figure Runaway, because of that name, oh, he probably just labored to come away with that name, Runaway, was black, and I figured the guy who died on him was black. He said, he just in this little bit right here, he's portrayed himself as long-suffering. I mean, because, you know, Runaway was there the first day, he was there the second day, then he comes back again, and then he says how controlled he was, he's long-suffering, he's controlled, you know, I didn't get upset with somebody as cowardly as Runaway, and then next thing you know, he's a one-man rescue. I went from building to building, rescuing not just soldiers, but Marines. I was rescuing Marines. And then he says, you know, all of those medals, who cares about those? You know, and once, next second, he's humble. The next thing, he's an instructor. I was telling everyone, using the pointer, giving PowerPoints, this is how you soldier on. Then he says, oh, you know, he's such a hero. Everybody was talking about him. He had no idea his exploits had gone so far and wide. The next thing, you know, he is. He's the priest. He's the the mortal confessor for this poor guy who's dying on him. And then he talks about how he has that genuine Puritan work ethic, how he just couldn't stand it when he had nothing to do and he just had to sit around and twiddle his thumbs. But at the same time, you know, he's just the common guy who happens to speak English better than most white hillbillies. I mean, this... Oh, he should have been... I don't know. What is that? I mean... I don't even know what kind of pathology that is. This something, we need a new word for narcissism. And we just need a brand new word. That was incredible that he could portray himself, like all those different things in was it just like two chapters? What was that? Anyway, I'm still in recovery. I'm always in recovery about the amount of destruction white people do to other people's homes. I mean, you know, they blew up doors until they ran out of explosives. I mean, they just ran out of explosives. And another thing I noticed was that he was saying, you know, that the insurgents were torturing the Iraqi guy, you know, just hanging him up and doing electrical torture. No one does that. Only Americans do that. They do that. Americans do that. They're always trying to find some kind of way of saying, we're not oppressing you. You're oppressing yourself. We're not torturing you. You're torturing yourselves. We're here to help. All of that pain and suffering, you did that to each other. So, and I also thought about the cemetery thing. You know, I'm sure that was just a funeral. You know, it's just so many people. He said, oh, so many people. They had to kill so many people. It was that many people showing up. It was definitely a funeral. So, I'm trying to think. Well, I guess, oh, yeah, that last thing about the satellites. What is he talking about? That, you know, people would be sitting out in the middle of anywhere with satellites. And he's supposed to be from Texas. I mean, I make use of so many satellites just to make it through the day. I mean, you know, we have remnants of those huge satellites that we had to, you know, pour cement foundation for here at the house. It's just, I mean, that's what Texas is. Texas is completely disconnected. I don't know why he would find satellites out in the middle of nowhere tacked onto a fallen apart trailer park along the side of the river to be, you know, strange. I mean, that's Texas. And the second thing is, the last thing, this is the last thing. When he was in the green zone, how horrible it was. The only way I could think of it to be that horrible is for you to be coked up and on meth and not be able to do anything. So, anyway, those are my observations.
All of the folks who have a hand up who haven't shared yet, your line should be open. Feel free to hop in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, this is Jamie in D.C., I just want to say hello to Gus and the callers, and to mention, I noticed something in the version of the text that I have that I thought was kind of interesting, and I was just curious if anybody else noticed it when he was talking about his longest confirmed kill, and he mentions that it was, I guess, 2,100 yards, but in the text, at least that's been what the narrator had stated, is that it was 2,100 yards, but the text that I had stated that it was 1,600 yards, and I just felt like it was kind of in line with, you know, any sort of fabrication that he's made throughout this text. I thought that was kind of interesting. I was wondering if it was just my version, or if there was probably, you know, if there was possibly something wrong with the narrator's interpretation of it or something. So I just didn't know if anybody that actually had the book, if they noticed that discrepancy. The other thing was in terms of Taya, his wife's point of view in the story. I just thought it really reinforces, whenever she sort of chimes in, it just kind of reinforces this whole idea that you really have to take it as racist man, woman, and child, because she just co-signs on everything, how he's telling her about, you know, about his tours and, you know, telling him about the people that he kills, and she's like, you know, I just thought that was really badass of him, or something to that effect. And I just really found that interesting, and it really just reinforced, like I said, that idea that it is racist man, woman, and child. So that's all I had to say. I'll mute myself.
My book says 1,600 yards as well, not 2,100. Did we miss anybody? Anybody on the line with a hand?
Can I be heard?
Yes.
How you doing, Gus? Thomas Smith from New York.
Greetings, sir.
How's to the callers? I had a few observations I made. The part where they talked about the kids being used as shields and the kids throwing grenades, how they're setting their kids up to die, to me, that showed the dedication that the Iraqis had to protect their land and, you know, say, listen, we don't even want our kids to be ruled by you. We're willing to let our kids die rather than have y'all rule over our kids. And, you know, to me, white people who enslaved their own kids and hung their own kids if they tried to leave or subjected their kids to the house to be tortured by their wives who were jealous of the fact that their husband had those kids. Not to mention the 18-year-old kid he mentioned. I mean, this is white people kill more kids than anyone. I can't believe that even came up. He talked about the insurgents like they were wrong for trying to help their fellow Arabs. You know, trying, like, he's on the rooftop trying to help his fellow Marines. I mean, here you're going into their country. I think the insurgents was trying to help them, you know. Some of them might have been out for their own agenda. I mean, just look how they all came together for this terrorism in France. I mean, they'll go, if God forbid someone ever went into a white country, I mean, U.S. would be there in a second to try to help. I mean, we call them the insurgents. They describe the Iraq like it was a nasty, disgusting, dirty, stinky place. And I said, man, they fought two wars there in about like 15 years, and they sanctioned them for that whole 15 years. I did a paper on Iraq when I was in school. I did a paper on the Middle East, and this was before the first war. And Iraq, based off of my research, was the most developed country pretty much over there, you know, with as far as plumbing and everything. So the fact that they had the sewage and stuff in the street, I don't blame anybody but the white people for that. They went over there and fought the wars, the first the Daddy Bush, then the other Bush. The bombs exploding just yards away. I mean, the technology they have to kill people is sickening. And then the innovation, I mean, they're making bombs using cheese and stuff like that. I mean, just, they talk about the Iraqi bomb makers. I mean, they're making bombs using cheese. This is white people here in America thinking of this stuff. Like, they're just, they're bringing their own guns to the war. He had the guy who lent him a gun. I mean, like, they came from America to Iraq with their own guns. They're having Thanksgiving dinner in Iraq. I mean, the story about Runaway, I agree with the other caller. I said, man, he's black. I got to see the movie if they do that part. I mean, he just sounds like he's describing a black guy. This punk, this sucker, he's scared. You know, we're on the rooftop, send up a Marine. You know, that's someone with some heart. You know, I could just see it. It seems like whites have problem fighting in fertile lands like swamps and marshes. I remember the jungles in Vietnam. Seems like they have a problem with that. And it seems to me like he already killed more than 160 people. If this is all accurate, I mean, he's killing people left and right. I mean, 10 here, you know, a whole, you know, group of them here. I mean, I'm way past 160. I don't know what constitutes a confirmed kill, but he's past that to me, if this is accurate. They're having fun with the beach balls. They enjoy watching them fight over one ball. You know, that was the fun of the days, just like how they enjoy watching us fight over the crumbs they try to give us. You know, look at them. You know, I could just see them having a big ball with that. Going house to house, the other guy mentioned that. They sound like the police serving warrants, you know, making arrests early in the morning on financiers and bomb dealers, bomb makers, like their drug dealers. Found it funny that Vice President had his friends in Iraq. You know, that was just like, wow. I mean, what? Yeah, at war with them. How bad could it be if they're sending over his friends? The first time I heard them talk, the first time I heard them talk about the army good, but I guess it's because they were good old boys and hillbillies. I guess so. He was trying to say these were some white boys. You know, they were cool with me, you know. I wrote you, I said, you know, most of the blacks, I think, in the military are in the army. You know, that's why I didn't think he was talking too good about the army. I mean, cool with the Marines, you know, he's in the Navy, but he never mentioned the army until anything positive until today. And the last thing I wanted to mention is funny how they're at war, And they're not having sex. I haven't heard any mention of them, you know, sleeping with these Iraqi women, I mean, or anything. It's kind of like, you know, just doesn't fit what I would think they do as a war. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, just like Vietnam, I mean, if you watch any movie, they got these Vietnamese courthouses and all types of things, or, you know, any movie where they ever did a war, you know, even when they show World War II, how the French women just threw themselves at the American soldiers, and, you know, but you're in Iraq and you're liberating these people and you're going house to house and y'all not doing nothing, just doesn't make sense, you know, especially if, you know, Cynical African always points out the amount of rape and molestation these people are into. I just find it funny that they're not sleeping with women or little boys or whatever they might do. You know, I just find it funny, and that's all my observations.
This is the age of ask and tell.
The caller at 2161, did you have contributions as well, 2161?
Yes, this is Scotty calling from North Carolina. Greetings, everyone. Just wanted to lend some of my observations about the observations that a few people have been discussing. I guess I will start with the last caller in terms of why it wasn't. The first thing is this. This is the most important thing. And I only became aware of this here recently, is that every military movie you see, any kind of movie that involves the military, if it's Iron Man, you know, in the plot of Iron Man, they're what? He's working with the military, creating all this. All of those scripts have to go be approved by the Department of Defense or the CIA, okay? And that's how they also underwrite their funding for the films. They get U.S. taxpayer money. Now, in exchange for that U.S. taxpayer money, the CIA, the United States military, the Department of Defense has the right to change their scripts and put in there what they want to put in there. So most of what you're seeing is propaganda and lies anyway. In terms of Chris Kyle, you know, y'all made a note that, okay, here's a discrepancy in, you know, how far was he when he made this kill? Is he just bragging? Is he just exaggerating and whatnot? And so, you know, all of it is fiction. It's not just him. Okay, he wrote the book. Somebody turned it into a screenplay. It was then, the script was then submitted to the Department of Defense, and then they edit or change or took out anything that they wanted to. I did not know until recently that this was the industry standard. So you have to consider that you're getting a bunch of lies anyway from Jump Street, you know, when it involves a military movie, period. One of the other observations that somebody commented on about the sex. Okay, why aren't you showing sex? Or what were these soldiers doing, you know? And the other movies, you know, like in Vietnam, we know they went to brothels. The also World War II, how they portrayed the French women. But see, that would be such an unbelievable lie in a Muslim country because of the modesty of Muslim women, because it would be considered, you know, capital offense. So you're not gonna see no whore houses or anything like that in their culture. Now, I had an opportunity to go to Saudi Arabia, and so it's going on, but it's going on with a certain class, the most richest Muslims. I can't comment on Iraq because I didn't go into Iraq. I was stationed in Saudi Arabia. And so you have American women that go over there for a year or so and sell themselves into, they sign a contract and go into a harem and be a harem. So they are having sex, so I'm not trying to make it look like, you know, Muslims are real moral people. It depends. But in the general population, you're not going to find any kind of whorehouses. Just like in Saudi Arabia, alcohol is illegal, but you can get it on the street, you know, on the street market. So it is being done now. But also in terms of sex, now, what may not have been, although I suspect that they probably were raping them women, but Anybody else paying attention to, you know, it's been military hearings on sexual assaults in the military. Lavina Johnson, PFC Lavina Johnson, you know, her story being raped and murdered, possibly by a CIA contractor, CIA, but a military contractor. So they were raping their own women. So, I mean, sexual assault is very high in the U.S. military. So if we're in Iraq and they didn't have an opportunity to rape the females of the local population, they certainly were raping their own soldiers. Okay. And that's something that they have admitted to. That is a problem. They've been having hearings on there. And the last observation of an observation that was made is how the kids are being portrayed. Don't necessarily believe that, you know, these kids were over there lobbing grenades. That's an old storyline. If you watch Vietnam movies, they will show you the same thing. You know, this kid has got a suicide bomber vest on. That's when I first noticed the suicide narrative. I'm not saying that some of it did not occur. What's a kid? You know, 13 years old, you know, in certain cultures, you consider a man. And, you know, I would hope that, you know, if it came down to it, you know, that my son would pick up a weapon and fight the enemy off, you know, fight off these invaders. But in terms of how they portray it, like little 6-year-olds, 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds with bombs, that's to portray those people of not caring about their own kids, don't value their own children's lives. And so, look, they're turning their children into walking bombs just to kill Americans and stuff. Well, what that also does to you is it does to the psyche is when you hear about all these little kids, innocent kids getting blown up by drones and stuff like that, when you hear about, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, and I don't want to share classified information, but let me just say this. They killed a whole lot of people in the first war when I was there. Okay. So the numbers are astronomical. So anyway, but that's to get you to say, okay, so what? They, you know, killed some kids over there. They don't even care about their own kids. So why should I care about their kids? That's what they're doing to you. So, you know, I wouldn't just be taking their word for it. You know, I have never heard a soldier talk about, and I did have contact with people who had been in combat. Although I wasn't combat, I was sort of what you might call combat support and communications. And I never, ever heard them talking about kids, you know, blowing themselves up just to get them. Okay, I would talk to them guys in the mess halls and things of that nature. So I just wanted to put into the context that, you know, white supremacy depends on confusion. And so all of this on Jump Street is being written by the military or strongly shaped by the United States military, including this movie about this racist monster. Okay, so that's all I wanted to share. Thank you for allowing me to.
Appreciate that. Mr. Scotty Reed, founder of the Black Talk Radio Network, threw me off as he dialed in from a different number this time. I caller down in Florida, retired firefighter. Do you have comments you want to get in as well?
Yes, sir. Listening to the first reading, they gave me the thought in mind. Well, actually, thoroughly through the book, that this white person, which I'm quite familiar with, is thinly under a thin veil of patriotism and fighting to protect his men and all of these gloristic terminologies and words and whatnot. Basically, it's a thin veil for the system of race fighting to maintain the system of racism and white supremacy, and through because of their need for genetic survival, as Dr. Wilson says, by any means necessary, they have that chip in their brains, embedded into their brains, very solid. They But at the same time, they are very deceptive into making non-white people think otherwise. They would even tolerate non-white people who are quote unquote fighting with them, as long as they follow that particular unwritten rule of white supremacy. And then even sometimes, as mentioned with this character in the book that was given this nickname, who I also suspect is a non-white person, that's the general attitude that they would have for that person in general, representing all non-white people in their opinion. As far as the sex activity with Vietnam, and I learned this even before I started reading up on, I learned it from a speech that Dr. King made when he started speaking out openly against the Vietnam War, and he mentioned how the white people called themselves French thoroughly corrupted the cultural and social background of those people that call themselves Vietnamese. They thoroughly corrupted their environment to whereas in a corrupted environment, the women are abandoned, literally abandoned, so to speak, and therefore it was like wide-scale rape that was going on, physical as well as from a standpoint, from a political standpoint, they were able to have sex with a lot of those people, and they are still between this part of the world and that part of the world, the results of the children of those people that were impacted by soldiers from this part of the world, sexually, I mean. But as Mr. Reed, I think, was stating, is that in the part of the world where the people call themselves Arabs, they have been impacted less from a social standpoint by white people. So therefore, it's probably a little bit more difficult to have this open air sexual activity between themselves as white people and their non-white enemies. Matter of fact, if anything, but a so-called record, I just read recently, and I also understand it from a historical standpoint, that the highest content of rape in war was with the Russian army against the Germans during the end of World War II. They were over, it was accounted to be over, it was in the millions as far as really rape that was going on during that time. So they were quite experienced at it, but they and then again, like Mr. Reed stated, which makes, you know, it's logical sense. You know, there's a lot of females in the military, and in turn, there's a lot of sexual activity that goes on within United States Armed Services alone as it is. You know, male-female, and female-female, as far as that concerned. You know, so the sex is going on, but as I mentioned, with this particular non-white enemy, they have been impacted less from a sense of being corrupted by these people. So that's probably why the content is a little bit more difficult. I put it that way, and I'll end my observations.
Gus, may I say something?
If you give me 1 second, I want to just pull out a couple quick notes, and then we should have a brief period of time. If folks have anything else they want to get in, you can get your comments in as well. Just to go real quick, some of the things that also stood out to me during the text. I guess number one, this is right at the very beginning of this week's segment. For me, this is page 248, where he's talking about the rules of engagement. where I brought this up consistently, and it ties right along in with that whole ploy that whites are moral, where you get oxymoron, civil war, and even when we are in battle and actively, deliberately trying to kill as many people as possible, we're still doing this in a just, reasonable manner, which is just absurd. It is malarkey of the highest order. But he says there were times when it wasn't exactly clear when a person almost surely was an insurgent, probably was doing evil, but there was still some doubt because of the circumstances or the surroundings. The way he moved, for example, wasn't toward an area where troops were. A lot of times a guy seemed to be acting macho for friends, completely unaware that I was watching him or that there were American troops nearby. Those shots I didn't take. Even that seems to directly contradict what he says way down the road about the beach ball incident, as well as the incident where he says he got either this 2,100-yard or 1,600-yard kill where they were out of range and the guys were bragging and all of that and making fun of them, and he went ahead and took their shot. Didn't seem like they were engaged in any quote-unquote evil acts of insurgency then, but I just think that's another part of racism, white supremacy, to always see whites as quote-unquote pure, quote-unquote fair, just, innocent, certainly not savages, certainly not terrorists. I was glad Jamie in D.C. brought it up, because that was a question that I'm just going to kind of leave hanging for the rest of the book. I meant to bring it up last week, but I think I just forgot to get it in. Why do you all think Taya is included? I don't think this is standard practice when you get an... And just for the record, this Chris Kyle did not write this book. That should be kept in mind. I think this is... I can't even say ghostwriter, because this is blatant. Like, he says this. I mentioned it last week. He did not write this book. It shouldn't even be called an autobiography. Some other white people, Scott McEwen and the other co-author for the text, a group of whites had already decided to construct this text about this figure, Chris Kyle, and he just was included in the project to say, well, okay, I can at least give my direct input to help shape the story that they're going to tell. But this is not, he did not write this book. Some other white people put this book together, and he just verbally gave his input. That should be kept in mind when we talk about the fabrications and what's true, what's not true. That should be kept in mind. That being said, for most quote-unquote autobiographies, you do not have an inclusion of another person, where this person's spouse or a parent or whomever else is included, and they get to give, you know, pages of text as well. Why is Taya included in this text? And I would go to page 260, where she says, as far as I can see, anyone who has a problem with what guys do over there is incapable of empathy. People want America to have a certain image when we fight, yet I would guess if someone were shooting at them and they had to hold their family members while they bled out against an enemy who hid behind their children, played dead only to throw a grenade as they got closer, and who had no qualms about sending their toddler to die from a grenade from which they personally pulled the pin, they would be less concerned with playing nicely. And she goes on to call him a badass, as one of the callers talked about when he's talking about some of the things that he did. Just that passage right there is huge in terms of giving the white woman stamp of approval to all of this. And that is something wrong with you if, you know, you have a problem or being critical or scrutinizing the conduct of race soldiers when they are out killing people and all the other things that they're accused of, including Lavina Johnson and these astronomical rates of rapes of their own troops, much less everybody else, and what's been coming out of late about torturing folks and what have you. Anyone scrutinizing or having a problem, there's something wrong with you. And using, again, that same line we talked about, they're sending out their children, they're sending out toddlers to launch grenades and all of that. I think that's huge to get that coming from this white woman, the dutiful wife. We talk about that all the time, the importance of having white women. They are integral to the system of white supremacy, and her signing off on all of this, I don't have a problem with it at all, even though he's coming home and almost breaking her arm in her sleep after he's been traumatized with all of this. For me, my book breaks right at the end of chapter 6, and it's a big section of photographs. Now, you hold what I just said in hand, right? Everybody's talked about this ongoing narrative of them talking about children as insurgents, and they're using children to throw bombs and hiding behind their children, and just a part of this dehumanization process that even the children, you can't even think of them as being innocent. Even the children are out to kill you and throw grenades and the whole nine, so we got to kill them too. The end of chapter 6 It has a picture of Chris Kyle. He looks like, if I had to eyeball it, I would say he looks like he's maybe 3 or 4, and he's got a gun. Keep Tamir Rice in mind, too. He's 3 or 4. He's got a gun. They keep going through. They show him at like 6 with his brother. They show him at like 6, 8, 10, armed. They show him again. He's maybe 16, armed, rifle in his hand. Bam, bam, bam. Shooting, killing animals, the whole nine. Tons of pictures with him armed and happy. Like, I cannot function. I mean, everything about Dr. Welsing as well, the symbolism of the gun. All of that. It's just tons and tons of pictures. So proud, so happy with my rifle in action, shooting to kill. They got pictures of him in combat as well. They have pictures of the symbol of the Punisher, which he brags about as well. In fact, he has a picture of the symbol that he uses for his security company after he allegedly retires right from the service. And it says, "Despite what your mama told you, violence does solve problems." And that's the slogan for his company. And they even have that. They have that around. That's a part of the logo, right? It's written around the skull, which has got a sniper scope on it as well. Violence does solve problems. And I've heard white people say that before. I think the other way that I've heard it is violence solves everything. I've heard white people say that before, but that is the mindset, that is the logic of racist man, racist woman, racist child. And just, again, the significance of Taya in my book, this picture with the logo is on one page, the page that's directly across from us. So if you have the book open, you'd see the logo, and then you see a picture of Chris Kyle and his wife, Taya Kyle, racist man, racist woman, inseparable duo. The next thing... Oh, yeah, I thought the scene about the Caucasians as well, we are supposed to be here killing non-white people. The people that are supposed to be on my team are supposed to be white. And how it confused him momentarily, like, wait a minute, these are white people. Am I supposed to shoot them? Are they down with me? How he was confused for a moment and then figured out, oh, okay, I need to shoot them too. They are not down with us on our team. I thought that was hugely important as well, just the programming. We are supposed to be here killing non-white people. Those are the folks that we're supposed to be enjoying, taking glee, killing them. The last thing I'll get in, I already touched on the cemeteries, bragging, where he's bragging about this non-white person being decapitated and all the other deaths that came about from this. I thought that was significant as well. Religion of white supremacy. I can end right there. When he's bragging about this shot where the discrepancy that Jamie and DC pointed out, 2100 or 1600, where he says the moon, earth, and stars aligned. God blew on the bullet, and I gut shot the jackass. His two putties hauled ass out of there. Get him, yelled the Marines. Shoot him. Just that right there. Again, this is God ordained. I watched the movie. I didn't get to see. I think I have like 20 minutes left. I do not think Runaway is included in the movie. Maybe he's in the last 20 minutes, but I don't think Runaway is in the movie. The scene about the tortures, so-called savages, these non-white people torturing and cutting off limbs and all that, that is in the movie, to just further drill that home, that these folks are inhuman and, you know, all of them, women, children, babies, anybody, old people, all of them deserve what they get, and we should kill them all, and anybody's got a problem with it, you're not a patriot, you're not an American, and, you know, you can ride with them too, type of a thing. We really need to get to the second audio segment. In fact, there's one person who called in who did not get to share. If you can make it concise, like 60 seconds, so we can get to the next audio clip, that would be fantastic. The person who just dialed in, did you have something you wanted to get in briefly before we get to the next audio clip?
No, you can go ahead.
You sure?
You got some answer something?
Can you make it quick?
Real quick. Force Recon, Navy SEALs, Delta Force, there is a huge homosexuality community in these special forces. They all derive from Sparta, the Spartans. And if you go back and even look at the recent movie 300, you'll see that homosexuality aspect. That's just in harmony with the what's going on with the sexual aspect of the whole story. And also, just one more thing with the hillbilly sentiments that were talked about. I have several family members that were in the Special Forces. Matter of fact, some of them were some of the first black ones accepted. And some of the stories that they tell, such as this flatulence game that whites used to play, one of them being a white person would lay on their back with their legs crouched, and other whites crouched around their bottom posterior with either a lit match or a cigarette lighter. And the white person would flagellate, and the game would be who could light the flame up the highest. I think that's the Welton moment with the games of these white pathology.
Absolutely.
That these people have.
Absolutely.
Just real quick, I have more, but let's get back to the audio.
Amen. If anybody else, if you had more things to share, just jot it down. We should have time once the second audio clip concludes for you to get it in. I will say just quickly, the reports that have come out, people talk about they have been trying to pass new legislation to stop all of the rape and sexual terrorism that's going on. And this is U.S. military troops assaulting and sexually terrorizing other U.S. Personnel. It has come out several times. I heard this on Democracy Now! And several other reports. Most of the victims are other males.
Exactly.
Now, there's a lot of females that are being sexually assaulted. Absolutely. But they have said this a couple of times. I don't think it's got that much attention. Most of the victims are males. Now, I don't know if that does that qualify as homosexual activity or what's going on there. But that's something folks should keep in mind as we are reading this text as well. We'll go ahead and pick up with the text. We are, for me, it is on 341. I don't know if, you know, folks are following along, but for me, it's 341, chapter 7. The subtitle is Calling Home. Calling Home, chapter 7, American Sniper Chris Kyle, context of white supremacy.
Calling Home. One night I was on an overwatch and things were quiet. Nights were normally slow in Baghdad. Insurgents usually wouldn't attack then because they knew we had the advantage with our technology, including our night vision gear and infrared sensors. So I thought I'd take a minute and call my wife back home just to tell I was thinking of her. I took our sat phone and dialed home. Most times when I talked to Taya, I'd tell her I was back at base, even though I was really on an overwatch or in the field somewhere. I didn't want to worry her. This night, for some reason, I told her what I was doing. "Is it all right to talk?" she asked. "Oh, yeah, it's all good," I said. "There's nothing going on." Well, I got maybe another two or three sentences out of my mouth when someone started firing at the building from the street. "What's that?" she asked. "Oh, nothing," I said nonchalantly. Of course, the gunfire stoked up real loud as the words came out of my mouth. "Chris?" "Well, I think I'm going to get going now," I told her. "Are you okay?" "Oh, yeah, it's all good," I lied. "Nothing happening. Talk to you later." Just then, an RPG hit the outside wall right near me. Some of the building smacked into my face, giving me a couple of beauty marks and temporary tattoos courtesy of the insurgency. I dropped the phone and started returning fire. I spotted the guys down the street and popped one or two. The snipers who were with me downed a bunch more before the rest got the hell out of there. Fight over, I grabbed up the phone. The batteries had run out, so I couldn't call back. Things got busy for a few days, and it wasn't until two or three days later when I finally got a chance to call Taya and see how she was. She started crying as soon as she answered the phone. It turned out I hadn't actually ended the call before I put the phone down. She'd heard the whole gunfight, complete with shots and curses, before the batteries had finally run out, which, of course, happened all of a sudden, adding to the anxiety. I tried to calm her down, but I doubt what I said really eased her mind. She was always a good sport, always insisting that I didn't have to hide things from her. She claimed her imagination was a lot worse than anything that really could happen to me. I don't know about that. I made a few other calls home during lulls and battles during my deployments. The overall pace of the action was so intense and continuous that there weren't many alternatives. Waiting until I got back to our camp might mean waiting for a week or more, and while I'd call then, too, if I could, it wasn't always possible. And I got used to the battles. Getting shot at was just part of the job. RPG round? Just another day at the office. My dad has a story about hearing from me at work one day when I hadn't a chance to call in a while. He picked up the phone and was surprised to hear my voice. He was even more surprised that I was whispering. "Chris, why is your voice so hushed?" he asked. "I'm on an op, Dad. I don't want them to know where I'm at." "Oh," he answered, a little shaken. I doubt I was actually close enough for the enemy to hear anything, but my father swears that a few seconds later there were gunshots in the background. "Gotta go," I said before he had a chance to find out what the sound was. "I'll get back to you." According to my father, I called back 2 days later to apologize for hanging up so abruptly. When he asked if he had overheard a start of a firefight, I changed the subject. Building my rep. My knees were still hurting from being pinned under rubble back in Fallujah. I tried to get cortisone shots, but couldn't. I didn't want to push too hard. I was afraid of getting pulled out because of my injury. Every once in a while, I took some Motrin and iced them down. That was about it. In battle, of course, I was fine. When your adrenaline is pumped, you don't feel anything. Even with the pain, I loved what I was doing. Maybe war isn't really fun, but I certainly was enjoying it. It suited me. By this time, I had a bit of a reputation as a sniper. I had a lot of confirmed kills. It was now a very good number for such a short period, or any period, really. Except for the team guys, people didn't really know my name and face, but there were rumors around, and my stay here added to my reputation, such as it was. Seemed like everywhere I set up, I'd get a target. This started to piss off some of the other snipers, who could spend whole shifts and even days without seeing anybody, let alone an insurgent. One day, Smurf, a fellow SEAL, started following me around as we went into an apartment. "Where are you setting up?" he asked. I looked around and found a place I thought looked good. "Right there," I told him. "Good. Get the hell out of here. I'm taking this spot." "Hey, you take it," I told him. I went off and found another spot, and promptly got a kill from there. For a while, it didn't seem to matter what I did. Things would happen in front of me. I wasn't inventing the incidents. I had witnesses for all my shots. Maybe I saw a little farther. Maybe I anticipated trouble better than other people. Or, most likely, I was just lucky. Assuming being a target for people who want to kill you can be considered luck. One time we were in a house on Haifa Street where we had so many snipers that the only possible place to shoot from was a tiny window above a toilet. I had to actually stand up the whole time. I still got 2 kills. I was just one lucky motherfucker. One day we got intel that the insurgents were using a cemetery at the edge of town near Camp Independence at the airport to cache weapons and launch attacks. The only way I could get a view of the place was to climb up on this tall, tall crane. Once at the top, I then had to go out on a thin mesh platform. I don't know how high I went. I don't want to know. Heights are not my favorite thing. It makes my balls go in my throat just thinking about it. The crane did give me a decent view of the cemetery, which was about 800 yards away. I never took a shot from there. I never saw anything aside from mourners and funerals, but it was worth a try. Besides looking for people with IEDs, we had to watch out for the bombs themselves. They were everywhere, occasionally even in the apartment buildings. One team narrowly escaped one afternoon, the explosives going off just after they collapsed down and left the building. The guard was using Bradleys to get around. The Bradley looks a bit like a tank, since it has a turret and gun on top, but it's actually a personnel carrier and scout vehicle, depending on its configuration. I believe it's made to fit 6 people inside. We would try and cram 8 or 10 in. It was hot, muggy, and claustrophobic. Unless you were sitting by the ramp, you couldn't see anything. You kind of sucked it up and waited to get wherever it was you were going. One day the Bradleys picked us up from a sniper op. We had just turned off Haifa onto one of the side streets, and all of a sudden, blam! We'd been hit by a massive IED. The back of the vehicle lifted up and slammed back down, the inside filled with smoke. I could see the guy across from me moving his mouth, but I couldn't hear a word. The blast had blown out my ears. The next thing I knew, the Bradley started moving again. That was one tough vehicle. Back at the base, the commander kind of shrugged it off. "Didn't even knock the tracks off," he said. He almost sounded disappointed. It's a cliche, but it's true. You form tight friendships in war, and then suddenly circumstances change. I became close friends with two guys in the guard unit, real good friends. I trusted them with my life. Today I couldn't tell you their names if my life depended on it, and I'm not even sure that I can describe them in a way that would show you why they were special. Me and the boys from Arkansas seemed to get along real well together, maybe because we were all just country boys. Well, they were hillbillies. You got your regular redneck like me, then you got your hillbilly, who's a whole sight different animal. Onward. The elections came and went. The media back in the States made a big thing of the Iraqi government elections, but it was a non-event for me. I wasn't even out that day. I caught it on TV. I never really believed the Iraqis would turn the country into a truly functioning democracy, but I thought at one point that there was a chance. I don't know that I believe that now. It's a pretty corrupt place. But I didn't risk my life to bring democracy to Iraq. I risked my life for my buddies, to protect my friends and fellow countrymen. I went to war for my country, not Iraq. My country sent me out there so that bullshit wouldn't make its way back to our shores. I never once fought for the Iraqis. I couldn't give a flying fuck about them. A short while after the election, I was sent back to my SEAL platoon. Our time in Iraq was growing short, and I was starting to look forward to going home. Being at camp in Baghdad meant I had my own little room. My personal gear filled 4 or 5 cruise boxes, 2 big Stanley roller boxes, and assorted rucks. Cruise boxes are the modern equivalent of footlockers. They're waterproof and roughly 3 feet long. On deployment, we pack heavy. I also had a TV set. All the latest movies were on pirated DVDs selling at Baghdad street stands for $5. I bought a box set of James Bond movies, some Clint Eastwood, John Wayne. I love John Wayne. I love his cowboy movies especially, which makes sense, I guess. Rio Bravo may be my favorite. Besides movies, I spent a bit of time playing computer games. Command and Conquer became a personal favorite. Smurf had a PlayStation, and we started getting into playing Tiger Woods. I kicked his butt. DAs, helos, and heights. With Baghdad settling down, at least for the moment, the headshed decided they wanted to open up a SEAL base in Habaniya. Habaniya is 12 miles to the east of Fallujah in Anbar province. It wasn't quite the hotbed of the insurgency that Fallujah had been, but it wasn't San Diego either. This is the area where, before the first Gulf War, Saddam built chemical plants devoted to manufacturing weapons of mass destruction, such as nerve gas and other chemical agents. There weren't a lot of American supporters out there. There was a U.S. Army base, though, run by the famous 506th Regiment, the Band of Brothers. They'd just come over from Korea and, to be polite, had no fucking clue what Iraq was all about. I suppose everybody's got to learn the hard way. Habaniya turned out to be a real pain in the ass. We'd been given an abandoned building, but it was nowhere near adequate for what we needed. We had to build a TOC, a Tactical Operations Command, to house all the computers and comm gear that helped support us during our missions. Our morale sunk. We weren't doing anything useful for the war. We were working as carpenters. It's an honorable profession, but it's not ours. Taya. It was on this deployment that the medical doctors did a test and, for some reason, thought Chris had TB. The doctors told him he would eventually die of the disease. I remember talking to him right after he got the news. He was fatalistic about it. He'd already accepted that he was going to die, and he wanted to do it there, not at home from a disease he couldn't fight with a gun or his fists. "It doesn't matter," he told me. "I'll die, and you'll find someone else. People die out here all the time. Their wives go on and find someone else." I tried to explain to him that he was irreplaceable to me. When that didn't seem to faze him, I tried another equally valid point. "But you've got our son," I told him. "So what? You'll find someone else, and that guy will raise him. I think he was seeing death so often that he started to believe people were replaceable. It broke my heart. He truly believed that. I still hate to think that. He thought dying on the battlefield was the greatest. I tried to tell him differently, but he didn't believe it. They redid the tests, and Chris was cleared, but his attitude about death stayed. Once the camp was settled, we started doing DAs. We'd be given the name and location of a suspected insurgent, hit his house at night, then come back and deposit him and whatever evidence we gathered at the DIF, detention and interrogation facility, your basic jail. We'd take pictures along the way. We weren't sightseeing. We were covering our butts, and more important, those of our commanders. The pictures proved we hadn't beaten the crap out of him. Most of these ops were routine, without much trouble, and almost never any resistance. One night, though, one of our guys went into a house where a rather portly Iraqi decided he didn't want to come along nicely. He started to tussle. Now, from our perspective, our brother SEAL was getting the shit kicked out of him. According to the SEAL in question, he had actually slipped and was in no need of assistance. I guess you can interpret it any way you want. We all rushed in and grabbed the fatso before he could do much harm. Our friend got ribbed about his fall for a while. On most of these missions, we had photos of the person we were supposed to get. In that case, the rest of the intelligence tended to be pretty accurate. The guy was almost always where he was supposed to be, and things pretty much followed the outline we had drawn up. But some cases didn't go so smoothly. We began realizing that if we didn't have a photo, the intelligence was suspect. Knowing that the Americans would bring a suspect in, people were using tips to settle grievances or feuds. They'd talk to the Army or some other authority, making claims about a person helping the insurgency or committing some other crime. It sucked for the person we arrested, but I didn't get all that worked up about it. It was just one more example of how screwed up the country was. Second guest. One day the Army asked for a sniper overwatch for a 506th convoy that was coming into base. I went out with a small team and we took down a 3- or 4-story building. I set up in the top floor and started watching the area. Pretty soon the convoy headed down the road. As I was watching the area, a man came out of a building near the road and began maneuvering in the direction the convoy was going to take. He had an AK. I shot him. He went down. The convoy continued through. A bunch of other Iraqis came out and gathered around the guy I'd shot, but nobody that I could see made any threatening motions toward the convoy or looked to be in a position to attack it, so I didn't fire. A few minutes later, I heard on the radio that the Army is sending a unit out to investigate why I shot him. Huh? I had already told the Army command on the radio what had happened, but I got back on the radio and repeated it. I was surprised. They didn't believe me. A tank commander came out and interviewed the dead man's wife. She told them her husband was on his way to the mosque carrying a Quran. Uh-huh. The story was ridiculous, but the officer, whom I'm guessing hadn't been in Iraq very long, didn't believe me. The soldiers began to look around for the rifle, but by that time so many people had been in the area that it was long gone. The tank commander pointed out my position. Did it come from there? Yes, yes, said the woman, who, of course, had no idea where the shot had come from since she hadn't been anywhere nearby. I know he's Army because he's wearing an Army uniform. Now, I was 2 rooms deep with a screen in front of me, wearing a gray jacket over my SEAL camis. Maybe she hallucinated in her grief, or maybe she just said whatever she thought would give me grief. We were recalled to base and the entire platoon put on stand down. I was told I was not operationally available. I was confined to base while the 506th investigated the incident further. The colonel wanted to interview me. My officer came with me. We were all pissed. The ROEs had been followed. I had plenty of witnesses. It was the Army investigators who had screwed up. I had trouble holding my tongue. At one point, I told the Army colonel, I don't shoot people with Qurans. I'd like to, but I don't. I guess I was a little hot. Well, after 3 days and God only knows how much other investigation, He finally realized that it had been a good kill and dropped the matter. But when the regiment asked for more overwatches, we told him to fuck off. "Anytime I shoot someone, you're just going to try and have me executed," I said. "No way." We were heading home in 2 weeks anyway. Aside from a few more DAs, I spent most of that time playing video games, watching porn, and working out. I finished that deployment with a substantial number of confirmed sniper kills. Most happened in Fallujah. Carlos Norman Hathcock II, the most famous member of the sniping profession, a true legend and a man whom I look up to, tallied 93 confirmed kills during his 3 years of tours in the Vietnam War. I'm not saying I was in his class. In my mind, he was and always will be the greatest sniper ever. But in sheer numbers, at least, I was close enough for people to start thinking I'd done a hell of a job.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Audible.
Harper Audio presents American Sniper, the autobiography of the most lethal sniper in U.S. military history, by Chris Kyle, with Scott McEwen and Jim DeFelice. 8. Family Conflicts. Taya. We went out to the tarmac to wait for the plane when it came in. There were a few wives and children. I came out with our baby and I felt so excited. I was over the moon. I remember turning to one of the women I was with and saying, "Isn't this great? Isn't this exciting? I can't stand it." She said, "Eh." I thought to myself, "Well, maybe I'm still new to it." Later on, she and her husband, the SEAL in Chris's platoon, got divorced. Bonding. I left the States some 7 months before, only 10 days after my son was born. I loved him, but as I mentioned earlier, we really hadn't had a chance to bond. Newborns are just a bundle of needs. Feed him, clean him, get him to rest. Now he had a personality. He was crawling. He was more of a person. I'd see him growing up in the photos Taya had sent me, but this was more intense. He was my son. We'd lie on the floor in our pajamas and play together. He'd crawl all over me, and I'd boost him up and carry him all around. Even the simplest things, like him touching my face, were a joy. But the transition from war to home was still a shock. One day, we'd been fighting. The next, we'd crossed the river to Altacottam Air Base, known to us as TQ, and started back for the States. War one day, peace the next. Every time you come home, it's weird, especially in California. The simplest things can upset you. Take traffic. You're driving on the road, everything's crowded, it's craziness. You're still thinking IEDs. You see a piece of trash and you swerve. You drive aggressively toward other drivers, because that's the way you do it in Iraq. I would shut myself in for about a week. I think that's where Taya and I started having problems. Being parents for the first time, we had the disagreements everyone has about children. Co-sleeping, for instance. Taya had my son sleep with her in a co-sleeper in the bed while I was gone. When I came home, I wanted to change that. We disagreed quite a bit on that. I thought he should be in his own crib in his own room. Taya saw it as depriving her of her closeness with him. She thought we should transition him gradually. That wasn't how I saw it at all. I felt children should sleep in their own beds and rooms. I know now that issues like that are common, but there was added stress. She'd been raising him completely on her own for months now, and I was intruding on her routines and ways of doing things. They were incredibly close, which I thought was great, but I wanted to be with them too. I wasn't trying to come between them, just add myself back into the family. As it happened, none of that was a big deal for my son. He slept just fine, and he still has a very special relationship with his mom. Life at home had its interesting moments, though the drama was very different. Our neighbors and close friends were completely respectful of my need for time to decompress. Once that was over, they put together a little welcome home barbecue. They'd all been great while I was gone. The people across the street arranged to have someone cut our grass, which was huge to us financially, and helped Taya with the heavy load she carried while I was gone. It seemed like a little thing, but it was big to me. Now that I was home, of course, it was my job to take care of things like that. We had a small, itty-bitty backyard. It took all of 5 minutes to cut the grass back there. But on one side of the yard were climbing roses that climbed up these potato bush trees we had. The bushes had little purple flowers on them year-round. The combination looked really pretty, but the roses had thorns in them that could pierce an armored vest. Every time I'd mow the yard and come around the corner, I'd get snagged by them. One day those roses just went too far, tearing at my side. I decided to take care of them once and for all. I picked up my lawnmower, held it up about chest high, and trimmed those mothers, the roses and the trees, down. "What? Are you kidding me?" yelled Taya. "Are you trimming the bushes with the lawnmower?" Hey, it worked. They never snagged me again. I did do some genuinely goofy stuff. Having fun and making other people smile and laugh has always been something I like to do. One day I saw our backyard neighbor through our kitchen window, so I stood on a chair and knocked on the window to get her attention. I proceeded to moon her. Her husband happened to be a Navy pilot, so I'm sure she was familiar with such things. Taya rolled her eyes. She was amused, I think, though she wouldn't admit it. "Who does that?" she said to me. "She laughed, didn't she?" I said. "You are 30 years old," she said. "Who does that?" There's a side of me that loves to pull pranks on people, to get them to laugh. You can't do regular stuff. I want them to have a good time. Belly laughs. The more extreme, the better. April Fool's Day is a particularly tough time for my family and friends, though more because of Taya's pranks than my own. I guess we both like to have a good laugh. On the darker side, I was extremely hot-headed. I have always had a temper, even before becoming a SEAL, but it was more explosive now. If someone cut me off, not a very rare occurrence in California, I could get crazy. I might try and run them off the road, or even stop and whoop their ass. I had to work at calming down. Of course, having a reputation as a SEAL does have its advantages. At my sister-in-law's wedding, the preacher and I got to talking. At some point, the preacher was a lady, noticed a bulge in my jacket. "You have a gun?" she asked. "Yes, I do," I said, explaining that I was in the military. She may or may not have known that I was a SEAL. I didn't tell her, but word tends to get around. But when she was ready to start the ceremony and couldn't get anyone in the crowd to be quiet and get into place, she came over to me, patted me on the back, and said, "Can you get everyone to sit down?" "Yes, I can," I told her. I barely had to raise my voice to get that little ceremony going. Taya, people talk about physical love and need when someone comes home from a long absence. "I want to rip your clothes off," that sort of thing. I felt that way in theory, but the reality was always a little different. I needed to get to know him again. It was strange. There's so much anticipation. You miss them so much when they deploy, and you want them to be home, but then when they are, things aren't perfect, and you feel as if they should be. Depending on the deployment and what I'd been through, I also had emotions ranging from sadness to anxiety to anger. When he came back after this deployment, I felt almost shy. I was a new mother and had been doing things on my own for months. We were both changing and growing in totally separate worlds. He had no first-hand knowledge of mine, and I had no first-hand knowledge of his. I also felt bad for Chris. He was wondering what was wrong. There was distance between us that neither one of us could really fix or even talk about. Breaking and entering. We had a long break from war, but we were busy the whole time, retraining and, in some cases, learning new skills. I went to a school run by FBI agents and CIA and NSA officers. They taught me how to do things like pick locks and steal cars. I loved it. The fact that it was in New Orleans didn't hurt either. Learning how to blend in and go undercover, I cultivated my inner jazz musician and grew a goatee. Lock picking was a revelation. We worked on a variety of locks, and by the end of the class, I don't think there was a lock that could have kept me or anyone else in our class at bay. Stealing cars was a little harder, but I got pretty good at that, too. We were trained to wear cameras and eavesdropping devices without getting caught. To prove that we could, we had to get the devices into a strip club and return with video evidence that we'd been there. The sacrifices you make for your country. I stole a car off Bourbon Street as part of my final. I had to put it back when we were done. As far as I know, the owner was none the wiser. Unfortunately, these are all perishable skills. I can still pick a lock, but it'll take me longer now. I'll have to brush up if I ever decide to go crooked. Among our more normal rotations was recertification class for parachuting. Jumping out of planes, or I should say, landing safely after jumping out of planes, is an important skill, but it's a dangerous one. Hell, I've heard it said the Army figures in combat, if they get 70% of the guys in a unit to land safely enough to rally and fight, they're doing well. Think about that. 1,000 guys, 300 don't make it. Not a big deal to the Army. Okay. I went to Fort Benning to train with the Army right after I first became a SEAL. I guess I should have realized what I was in for on the first day of school when a soldier just ahead of me refused to jump. We all stood there waiting and thinking while the instructors tended to him. I'm afraid of heights as it is, and this didn't build my confidence. Holy shit, I wondered. What's he seeing that I'm not? Being a SEAL, I had to make a good showing, or at least not look like a wimp. Once he was taken out of the way, I closed my eyes and plunged ahead. It was on one of those early static jumps, jumps where the cord is automatically pulled for you, a procedure usually used for beginners, that I made the mistake of looking up to check my canopy as I left the plane. They tell you not to do that. I was wondering why when the chute deployed. My tremendous sense of relief that I had a canopy and wasn't going to die was mitigated by the rope burns on both sides of my face. The reason they tell you not to look up is so that you don't get hit by the risers as they fly by your head when the chute opens. Some things you learn the hard way. And then there are night jumps. You can't see the land coming. You know you have to roll into PLFs, parachute landing falls, but when? I tell myself the first time I feel something, I'm going to roll. The first time? The first? I think I banged my head every time I jumped at night. I will say I preferred free fall to static jumping. I'm not saying I enjoyed it, just that I liked it a lot better. Kind of like picking the firing squad over being hanged. In free fall, you come down a lot slower and had much more control. I know there are all these videos of people doing stunts and tricks, having a grand old time doing halo, high altitude, low opening jumps. There are none of me. I watch my wrist altimeter the whole time. That cord is pulled the split second I hit the right altitude. On my last jump with the Army, another jumper came right under me as we descended. When that happens, the lower canopy can steal the air beneath you. The result is, you fall faster than you were falling. The consequences can be pretty dramatic, depending on the circumstances. In this case, I was 70 feet from the ground. I ended up falling from there, and having a couple of tree branches and the ground beat the crap out of me. I walked away with some bumps and bruises and a few broken ribs. Fortunately, it was the last jump of the school. My ribs and I soldiered on, glad to be done. Of course, as bad as parachuting is, it beats spy rigging. Spy rigging may look cool, but one wrong move and you can spin off in Mexico, or Canada, or maybe even China. Strangely, though, I like helos. During this workup, my platoon worked with MH-6 Little Birds. Those are very small, very fast scout and attack helicopters adapted for special operations work. Our versions had benches fitted to each side. Three SEALs can sit on each bench. I loved them. True, I was scared to death getting on the damn thing, but once the pilot took off and we were in the air, I was hooked. It was a tremendous adrenaline rush. You're low and fast. It's awesome. The The momentum of the aircraft keeps you in place. You don't even feel any wind buffeting. And hell, if you fall, you'll never feel a thing. The pilots who commanded those aircraft are among the best in the world. They were all members of the 160th SOAR, the Special Operations Air Wing, hand-picked to work with spec warfare personnel. There's a difference, and it's noticeable. When you're fast roping from a chopper with a regular pilot, you may find yourself at the wrong altitude, too high for the rope to reach the ground. At that point, it's too late to do anything about it except grunt or groan as you hit the ground. A lot of pilots also have trouble holding station, staying put long enough for you to get in the right spot on the ground. Not so with the guys from SOAR. Right place, first time, every time. That rope drops, it's where it belongs.
Okie dokie. We will be picking up next time. For me, it is page 373. The subtitle is Marcus. This is in Chapter 8. We are beyond the halfway point. We should be done with this book in early February, maybe 3 more sessions, if I was to call it. But for me, 373, bottom of 373, Marcus, that is the subheading. Context of White Supremacy, number for folks to dial. If they would like to participate, again, it is 760-569-7676. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. I will point out, I think this is the second time we have almost done 3 years worth of the book club here on the Cows. I think this is the second time that we have been doing a book that was trending and was being talked about while we were reading it. I think the other time this happened was with 12 Years a Slave, right at the end of 2013. But this book has been trending on Twitter all day long. I think even yesterday as well, with the Oscar nominations coming out. And I think it just went to wide distribution this weekend. I think it set another record for Thursday. I think it made over $5 million yesterday in the theaters for folks who went out to see the movie. So should be timely, should be coming up if you're around, if you're on the job and people are talking about the text, pay attention to what they're saying. Check your local paper. As I said, they had a big article in the LA Times today. New York Times already had a big article, so you can be paying attention. This is one that I thought from the very beginning you should have a lot of opportunities to do some background check and additional reading, see what white people are saying about this book and or film. That being said, feel free, chime in. Everyone who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open. I guess we'll nab the caller who did not get an opportunity to share last time around. You should be with us. Folks, have any thoughts on why or the significance, the importance of Taya and why she has such a continual role in the book, why people think that was included in the impact of her contribution? Folks want to chime in on that. I think that's something important that we should keep in mind from now to the close of the book. But our caller, female caller who had a hand up, do you have any comments you wanted to get in?
Yeah, I have a couple of comments. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, yeah. Where to start? At one point, he had made a comment about a good kill, and it reminded me of the book I'm reading right now, Without Sanctuary, where they had a term called a good lynching. And his persona, even if this guy, Chris Kyle, even if the book isn't real, this persona, this personality, you know what I mean, white people like this exist. And it just reminded me of those white men when they would go out lynching. And that's what he reminds me of when he goes to Iraq and kill these non-white people. And I was surprised that in the photos, he wasn't posing with any bodies. Because I'm pretty sure he does stuff like that. Because he hunts and do stuff like that. That's what they do. And also, he mentioned something about the weaponry, how advanced his weapons were from the Iraqis. And it was like, it's just like, it's a slaughter. Because obviously they're outgunned and outmanned. And like, at one point they said there were so many snipers, there weren't any spots. And like, he's like, yo, I still got two kills. And then he said, he made a comment at one point again saying that he's not in Iraq for the Iraqis. He doesn't care about them. And then his wife made a comment about him thinking people are replaceable. And I'm thinking, but you think the same thing because you promote what he's doing. And he's killing mad people. So obviously you think that they're replaceable or they don't even really matter. Yeah, and then he keeps pushing this thing about him being scared of heights, but you're killing mad people. Like, I don't know. I think that chick too, Taya, I think she's in there to kind of like make the book not so much about kill, and try to give him like a softer side, I would say. And yeah, that's all I have for right now. That's my notes.
Right on. Everybody else who has a hand up, your line should be open if you all have comments you want to get in.
Well, I didn't say good evening to everyone earlier. I'm sorry. Good evening, everyone. Good evening, Gus. I think his wife, of course, is in there to humanize the monster. But in the end, you know, the scariest part of this is that this is a book written about a white man, by white men, for white men. So, lie or not, it's their deepest desire, you know, and you have to believe people when they tell you who they are. I mean, you really shouldn't try to correct that or soften that or just take it as it is. You need to believe people when they tell you who they are. So, I mean, he's a monster. He really is. And it is very strange to me that in trying to take some of that monstrous behavior away, they had his wife in it. But I mean, things like being estranged from your wife, estranged from your child, estranged from your neighbors, estranged from the people that you come into contact with during the day. I mean, showing that is, they're thinking they're making him sound human. He even sounds less human. But, you know, it's just that whole group of people. I mean, they're just hopelessly monstrous. I mean, just soulless. I'll mute my line.
Other folks have comments they want to make sure that they get in. Thank you for the greeting, Karma. Other folks, everybody else with a hand up, line should be open.
Can I make one more comment?
Yes, ma'am.
At one point he said he was breaking into cars, and he said he was rusty. And he said that at one point if he wanted to go crooked, and I'm thinking, like, you've been crooked. You're a thief, and you're a murderer. How much more crooked can you get?
Amen. Amen. Even that, as I said, I think that's a major theme throughout this book, that even though he is a killer, a celebrated, worshipped white killer, he is still somehow innocent, pure, fair, just. Even with that, you don't think of him as being someone who is a criminal, who is a lawbreaker. You don't even think of him as a killer. He is out there practicing justice, Superman almost. In fact, the scene, someone asked me about the trailer, and there are different trailers for this. This is obviously a big Hollywood push, so I haven't seen all of them, but the ones that I have seen, the scene where It's, for me, it's on 343, where he says, he's talking about this phone conversation where he's talking to his wife, and then this gun battle breaks out. I do not think that that is true. I think that's made up. That just seems very Hollywood to me. Maybe it did happen, but to me, it just seems very fake. Also, since this is the trailer for the film, the one that I've seen the most, where he's having this discussion, and they really play it up. Like, in the trailer, she is pregnant with child, and she's coming from the hospital when all of this happens. And I think if that was really the way it went down, that would have been included in the book, right? They would have really made sure, you know, to get the most bang for their buck on a lie by making sure that was included, that she was, you know, just going to the hospital and making sure that the child was good and blah, blah, blah. And I mean, super, you know, several months pregnant, close to delivery date, and her breaking down in tears and all that. They just make it super over the top Hollywood for the trailer moment for this particular scene. But I think that is total fabrication. I think they just made that up as part of the propaganda effort with this film. And just with the point about him being a monster, him being a killer, where he says, building my rep. They go through all of these gymnastics to say that this is not about bragging about him killing all these non-white people, and he's not a monster, and he didn't love doing this. He was serving his country, serving his God, the religion of white supremacy. But they have a whole chapter on, this for me is 345, the subheading, Building My Rep, where his rep is about killing people. And he says, where he talks about being in pain, and he tough through it, that work ethic. I'm not going to let anything slow me down, and I'm just going out here and doing my job. And in fact, I was afraid to even bring up too much that I was in pain or had a problem, because I didn't want them to take me out. I didn't want to be, you know, removed from the field of battle and getting the opportunity to kill and slaughter other non-white people. He says, even with the pain, I loved what I was doing. Maybe war isn't really fun, but I certainly was enjoying it. It suited me. That right there, in my opinion, I would take them at their word. Whether this book is made up or not, white people, Mr. Nero, again, white people kill for fun. I believe that. And in my opinion, it's supported by evidence worldwide and centuries of it. White people kill for fun and then make movies and books and rejoice about killing for fun. He goes, and this is in the same subchapter, Building My Rep. He says, he's talking about he still got two kills even when he was in this bad position, wasn't very good. And he says he was just one lucky MF-er. And just even talking of it in that manner, being lucky because I still got to kill two people, I am lucky. That right there, in my opinion, that is racist logic. That is what it means to be white, the way you look at taking lives. Also in the same Building My Rep, he says, he's talking about heights, and he says, I don't know how high I went. I don't know. I don't want to know. Heights are not my favorite thing. It makes my balls go in my throat just thinking about it. To me, that would be another Dr. Welsing moment. This homoeroticism, there are just so many references to male genitalia and anuses and all of that. That just adds to it, what people have already discussed on that. In the same subheading, Building My Rep, where he talks about me and the boys from Arkansas seem to get along real well together, maybe because we were all just country boys. Well, they were hillbillies. You've got your regular redneck like me, and then you've got your hillbilly, who's a whole sight different animal. Fascinating. He didn't say person, human, guy, animal. Different animal, even almost suggesting that he too is an animal, which I would agree with. Monster. I would also slide in, he self-references as a redneck. I don't think quote-unquote rednecks are known for their affinity for coloreds, unless I've been misinformed. And I think that's another one that would appeal to a lot of white people. The good, like I said, I think that's a huge part of why they got somebody with such a strong southern accent reading the audiobook and the whole nine. I think that's just another aspect of appealing to that all quote unquote all American white man and what they're trying to get across with this text and the movie as well. The last thing I'll get in, so other folks have anything they want to touch on. Him talking about the movies, talking about the importance of television. I said last week, that's why I started last week's program with the opening from the movie Patton, which has already been mentioned in this book. But he says he loved John Wayne movies. The essence of why, I mean, this is revered white man. This is the Chris Kyle from 50 years ago, the previous generation's version of Chris Kyle. John Wayne, Clint Eastwood, same thing I said last week. That right there, it could be true, it could be false. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter, because either way, it just further reinforces the point about the reverence, the joy that white people have for killing, particularly killing non-white people, which is a core aspect of this book, this film, as well as Clint Eastwood's movies, Dirty Harry, John Wayne, all of that. It's the same thing, killing non-white people and being celebrated, being worshipped, being a god, the religion of white supremacy, for your skill killing non-white people. No accident, in my opinion, Clint Eastwood gets tabbed for best director. I would bet the farm when the Oscars come. I would bet everything on American Sniper to take everything, all of the big awards. I would be betting on American Sniper. Any of the other folks who had a hand up, your line should be open. Comments you wanted to get in?
Hello?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Yeah, just one thing I wanted to comment on was when Chris, when he, you know, he got his neighbor's attention and, you know, he mooned her and, you know, it was just all a joke and, you know, they both having a good time and I'm just thinking to myself, like, what, you know, it's just, I mean, that's like indecent, you know, exposure, like, you know, you're exposing yourself, you know, to, you know, a married woman and, you know, oh, her husband happened to be a Navy pilot, you know, I'm sure, you know, he's familiar with such, you know, she's familiar with such things, and I'm like, what, you know, what kind of things, you know, are, like, you know, I guess, you know, what they're down with, like, you know, they're just, this is something that they can just, you know, just laugh over, just, you know, just, like, you know, these crude, like, sexual jokes and stuff that they, you know, just they go in with, and Taya, just like, you know, oh, that's just Chris being Chris, you know, I don't know, that's all I just said.
Anybody else with us who has not shared yet, to make sure everybody gets at least one opportunity to share, anybody with a hand up who hasn't shared yet, your line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Gus, Thomas Smith again. Quickly, I had a few observations. You touched on a lot of them. The balls in his throat. I wrote that one down. I think Tay is in the book to because I think this is a lot of fiction, and I think she's in the book to give it some validity because she's still alive, and you know, she can be there to confirm some of this stuff, or the fact that she's not confirming some of this stuff, it makes it seem true. So I give it that, and I said it the last few weeks, and I still think it. I think it even more after reading that last segment. This is a huge propaganda book. So I mean, I could imagine the average white teenager sitting at home playing one of those video games where they're killing a bunch of people, and then they're reading about, you know, how fun it is to jump out of this plane and out of this helicopter and got a roll and you can't see the ground at night. I mean, I could just see that intriguing them. You touched on it, the lucky guy, you know, kills from wherever he is. Doesn't matter if he's laying down on his stomach or standing up or sitting down. I mean, you know, put him anywhere. He can pick a spot, someone take it. He goes to the next spot, got a couple of people, you know, I'm just the lucky guy, you know, I mean, it's just crazy. I always thought hillbillies was from like West Virginia and Kentucky. I didn't know they was from Arkansas. I thought those was just country people. But I didn't know. I mean, I'm from the New York area, so maybe I'm wrong. That when he said he wasn't, I think the other caller touched on it, he wasn't there to fight for the Iraqis. He was there to fight for American interests. He was there to fight for white supremacy. He wasn't there to fight for the little girls who couldn't read. All that stuff they sold us is the public. No, the military was there to kill them. You know, that was just pretty much it. And when he said he could just, with that whole investigation part, that to me was like, wow, that sounds like a police investigation here. You know, the shooting's a little questionable. They come and investigate him. You know, he just gets thrown on some type of leave for a little while. You know, they're not believing my story. You know, pretty much sound like the cops that's doing this stuff. You know, all he needed was a prosecutor there. He wouldn't have had any problem. And it was just how he said he could just shoot people. He wished he could shoot anybody walking around with a Quran. And, you know, with all this stuff going on in France, you know, it's funny how, like, this is how they really feel. You know, like, you know, they have no regard for those people. And I wouldn't be surprised if that stuff is all made up over there, but I won't even get into that. But that's all the observations I have.
Just real quick before I mute other folks that are on, if you have anything you want to get in. Number one, that scene about where he's brought up and they're going to investigate him and whether he violated the rules of engagement and his attitude about all that, I'm pretty sure the typical white reader, male or female, reading this text would sympathize with him. They would think that, oh, my God, I cannot believe he's out here fighting for our freedom, protecting our way of life. How are you going to, you know, try and bring him up and tell him he didn't do his job? Exactly what Taya said in the previous audio segment about, hey, you know, we can sit here and try to play tiddlywinks. This is war. We're going out here. These are savages, all of them, children, every last one of them. Absolutely. And just get the hell out of the way and let him do his job. You go ahead, Chris Kyle. But I also think that being included, just that right there lets me know this guy was probably doing a whole lot of incorrect things and killing people. The fact that it comes up at all that he was reprimanded or investigated about incorrect, that he killed so many people, that lets me know right there. That's just another bit of evidence that he was probably just lighting up all kinds of folks, whether they looked like they were doing something incorrect. Exactly. Take him at his word. He wished he could have killed anybody with the Quran. I believe you. Absolutely. Any non-white person that's over here, bam, you can get it. Bam, 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 bam. That's the way that I'm processing this. And even when he said, I would pair that, juxtapose that with his commentary about when he's not in conflict, combat. The portion where he said, this is the beginning of chapter 8 for me, family conflicts, where he says, the transition from war to home was still a shock. One day we'd be fighting, the next we'd be crossed the river to Al-Takatum Air Base. War one day, peace the next. Every time you come home, it's weird, especially in California. The simplest things can upset you. Take traffic. You're driving on the road. Everything's crowded. It's craziness. You're still thinking IEDs. You see a piece of trash and you swerve. You drive aggressively toward other drivers because that's the way you do it in Iraq. I would shut myself in for about a week. I think that's where Tay and I started having problems, where he talks about his road rage and how he would want to follow somebody if they cut him off on the road. This is 365. This is right for me. It's on the same page as him mooning the neighbor. He said, on the darker side, I was extremely hot-headed. I've always had a temper, even before becoming a SEAL. Thought that was because we talked about that before when he broke the pin out of his wrist, which was before he was even in the military. He said, but it was more explosive now. If someone cut me off, not a very rare occurrence in California, I could get crazy. I might try and run them off the road or even stop and whoop their ass. I totally take him at his word on that.
That's very believable. Very believable. Yep, that part for sure. And when he said his son or his baby, when he left, he was an infant, but now he's like a human being. He's calling. It was like, well, how do you say that about your own kid? I wish they had someone, a female doing Taya's voice, though, because it sounds a little funny with the country boy doing Taya's voice, you know, with that Bill Clinton accent. Just doesn't sound right. I wish they would have talked to the last of the Miss Gloot, and she could have probably got them a good voiceover for her.
Any other folks that are on the line have anything they want to make sure they got in?
Yes, sir. I find it fascinating with a lot of white males that admired John Wayne, and apparently he was one of them. John Wayne, you know, did all of these war movies or quote unquote cowboy movies, and he never was officially in the military, never did any military service at all. He was a member of the Birch Society, which is a offshoot of the Ku Klux Klan. I can recall
before on the job that I was on, there was a white. Literally had a shrine in the middle of the firehouse of John Wayne. I mean, he had artifacts, statues. He pictures that he had taken with him. You know, right in the middle of this fire station that took up, almost a third of the room itself on this guy. And I find it, quite fascinating, on how. White males especially admired John Wayne, primarily an actor and a racist in itself. The white male, by the way, firefighter, he ended up dying in line of duty. He had a heart attack based on an explosion that took place near him on the job. But I just noticed that in the book when he was talking about John Wayne and how much he revered him and whatnot, and what John Wayne actually was in reality. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure Clint Eastwood is in that same boat for another generation of Wife of Dirty Harry. And folks can remember his conduct during the 2012 presidential campaign. I believe it was at the Republican convention where he was one of the keynote speakers, and his commentary about President Obama back from 2012. Y'all can go check that out. But again, directing this film, which has been nominated for Best Picture among other potential Oscar wins. Any of the other folks on the line have anything quick they wanted to get in before we wrap up?
Yeah, I think Chris Kyle would like to bring his little baby son and his wife over. And that's where we're in Iraq with him. I think he could merge the two worlds, and then I think he'd be happy. That's what he really wanted. So I remember in the book, too, I think he gives his son a gun when he was like 2 years old, further along in the book. So I think he really wanted to get him hunting real early, get him killing real early.
Tamir Rice. While the New York Times has their big video montage towards the end of 2014 talking about we need to no longer have toy guns and we don't want to celebrate that or promote that. But they were only using Tamir Rice and John Crawford to make this point. They didn't include Chris Kyle and his son or other whites, even the white girl that shot and killed the gun instructor in 2000. They didn't include that. It was just black people.
Mm-hmm. That killed their mother in Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, real quick, I just was thinking. When those guys come back. Oh, the first thing I was thinking is John Wayne. He had went to go visit some troops and actually got jeered and booed and whatnot. So that's kind of weird. Like when he actually went to go see the troops, after making all these war movies, the troops wasn't receptive to him at all. So that's a pretty famous experience. And as far as the female, I think it just reminded me of like the Greeks or the Spartans, how the females were basically telling their husbands, sons, come home on your shield or something like that. Like don't basically telling them like don't come home, without dishonor. So I think like for the females that read the book, it's kind of like a little bit of training or whatnot. Like this is what you have to not just what you have to, but this is you have to support your husband and I'm hearing a lot of I'm hearing a lot of white females, man, basically saying that they want men, manlier men. So, like, if you see, like, right now, it's like a beard craze. Before all this beard, for all these cats growing, you know, white males, you know, growing their beards, I was hearing females on Red Ice Radio. They keep doing these shows talking about how Europe is being taken over by non-white people and white culture is being diluted and they're complaining about Thor not having a beard and, you know, there's several different white people. I mean, I guess if anybody is interested in that, you can just see them on there talking about, you know, they want manlier men and this and that. So, and, you know, like I've been on the freeway. I ride the train now, but I've been on the freeway and been called nigger on the train. And I mean, not on the train, but on the freeway by people passing by. And it's that road rage is real, and that anger, man. Like this whole, you know, CrossFit white, going to the gym, training and stuff. Like it's a lot more aggressive. You know what I'm saying? And I'm not a small person, and you can just see, like, you know, white people. They can tell if you like less confused. You know what I'm saying? And it seem like they're getting more aggressive. So, I was hearing that, like, really war tears up the psyche. Like these people are really, you know, doing these tours, man. Like, they're, you know, there's mad evidence in it. The psychological damage is, you know, is pretty immediate. Like after 2 weeks, man, like they're good for, you know, they're good for nothing. So, and they're doing, you know, they're, you know, a lot of these people are doing way more than 2 weeks, but they were saying like that's not psychologically healthy at all. Like, so, yeah, they're training psychopaths. And I was just thinking, like, are they coming, you know, a lot of them coming back and joining the police force and stuff. When he was talking about, he was, you know, quick to beat people up, quick to shoot IED, and his perception of, like, when his fellow soldier tripped, and in their perception, he was, you know, getting beat up or whatever, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, oh, the perception, you know, grab your wallet and, oh, it's a gun, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, these people that's going to war and all these military people, man, these people are going to be coming back if they survive out there. To be killers, guaranteed. It's guaranteed. One way or another, whether it's some vigilante or, you know, or they join the police force, fire department, whatever, they gonna probably kill somebody.
Absolutely. We will wrap things up for this week. We should be back next week. We're in chapter 8. We are beyond the halfway point. If I had to guess, I'd say maybe it's going to be 3 more of these. So if you you definitely should not pay any money to see this flick. But if you catch the film and you take any notes, you compare and contrast, we should have probably 3 more, if I had to guess, 3 more sessions before we're all done with the text. I would just point again, the logo that they used for their company after he left the military, despite what your mama told you, violence does solve problems. In my view, that speaks volume about the mindset of racist man, racist woman, racist child. And again, like I've heard this before, almost said verbatim, and I think this was years before this book was published. And it was violence solves everything. That was the way I heard it before, but that logic, that thought pattern is repetitious in the system of white supremacy because this system requires perpetual, ongoing death, murder, slaughter of non-white people and encourages, praises, rewards white people for carrying out this duty. Again, I bet the farm on American Sniper for the Oscars. I haven't checked the date for when they come out or what have you, if we'll still be on the book by that time, but I would bet the farm for them to win. Particularly Best Picture, I would bet the farm, American Sniper.
With that, we should be back tomorrow. Compensatory call-in, catch up on news, events that have happened over the past 7 days. Also, workplace racism. Folks have mailed in some interesting stories there as well. That'll be tomorrow evening, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We should have white women representing on the program this coming week, several different white women talking about different aspects of the system. So keep that in mind. We'll see if they have read this book, if they have any comments on it or what have you. But that, stay tuned. That should be interesting to hear from the woman in the system of white supremacy for next week. If you have any comments, I know we have folks that are following along with this text. If you have any comments, anything that you want to add in, if you're not able to participate live, you can email us untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. We can read them on air if you have things that stood out that you want to include in the text. If any of this, I know we have a lot of folks who seem to have some level of experience in the armed forces. If this seems accurate with your experience, if you can corroborate any of the things that we're hearing, you can feel free to add that in as well. Thanks to all the folks who participated. I hope it has been a constructive investment of your Friday evening. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and we can get you a physical mailing address to support the program. Huge thanks to all of the folks who have contributed and kept us rolling for almost 6 years. This is the weekend. I would, again, if you're going to go out, do any of that fooling around and all that other stuff, never know. It could be a Chris Kyle in the vehicle, Daniel Pantaleo, Darren Wilson that is pulling you over under conditions of war. Sobriety would be best. If you are going to consume any alcohol or other intoxicants, my recommendation, Codify, stay at your residence. If you're going to coordinate with other folks, stay at their residence until the next day. That way you can leave when you are sober, clear thinking, so you can make the best possible choices to preserve your life, the life of your family or other folks that you care about. You're just making racist jobs extremely easy if you get behind the wheel and you are intoxicated. And it doesn't even have to be a racist. It could just be a random Chris Kyle, who is waiting to pummel you because you cut him off, or he thinks you cut him off, or whatever the case may be. And I mean, it's white women that do this too. They had a video of a white woman who she thought it was a non-white motorist had done her wrong, and she started cursing him out, calling him all these racist names and threatening him and the whole nine. So just sobriety would be best. If you got to do all that, I would encourage not getting behind the wheel and codifying that behavior and making sure you are not in close proximity to other whites. You just don't want to be around terrorists while you are not lucid and clear thinking. That being said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us we should be striving for universal man, universal woman, as soon as possible. Help us manifest maximum levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places. Each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. One of our listeners, she tweeted before we signed out, she doesn't think that a child would have any sort of bond or would feel comfortable being around a person that this child has not been exposed to for the first 7 months of life, just saying that she also thought that that might be a fabrication, that Chris Kyle comes home and is chilling with his little baby and crawling all of them. She thought that that might be made up too, because she just can't see a seven-month-old being that comfortable with a total stranger, much less a psychopathic killer. And I would concur in that assessment as well. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem.
a victim.
Hey, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.